Good evening, everybody. Welcome. It's great to see such a big crowd here tonight. We have a couple of great recognitions at the start of the meeting. I'd like to call the October 26, 2015 regular meeting to order. Mr. Ellis, will you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge of Allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call, Mrs. Moak.
Mr. Bochinski.
Here.
Mr. Buckle. Here. Mrs. Clark.
Here.
Mr. Elder.
Here.
Mr. Ellis.
Here.
Mr. Escalante.
Here.
Here. Great. Recognition.
Well, one, thank you all for coming out tonight. I appreciate it. We have two recognitions. The first is October is National Principals Month, and this past Friday was the official Principal Appreciation Day. So I just wanted to take a moment during the board meeting. Up on the screen you can see some pictures to say thank you to our principals, our assistant principals, for your leadership, your commitment to our district, your dedication. Thank you for everything that you do on a daily basis to make our schools what they are. So thank you to each and every one of you for your dedication. So next, I'll be introducing Steve Dively. There he is. He's going to do an introduction of Yusuf Khan, who is the Time for Kids reporter, a great honor bestowed upon him. With that, Steve.
All right. Good evening, everybody. I'm here to introduce Yusuf Khan. Yusuf is an 8th grade student at Hadley Junior High. Last summer, Yusuf, together with 300 other students nationwide, submitted an application to be accepted as a reporter for Time for Kids. As the school year began this year, he learned that he had won that honor, and he has been chosen as a Time for Kids reporter. This honor was bestowed upon only 10 children in the entire country, and he is the only reporter chosen within Illinois. Last year, Yusuf also received third place in a Torrance Legacy Writing Contest for his poem titled The Moon. This was an international writing competition with a published anthology. Yusuf has also won awards at the district level for his work on the Reflections Contest, and that much of the reason for his success he credits to his family, his mother, father, sister, other family members, and a well-rounded and rigorous education here in District 41. When not writing, Yusuf greatly enjoys reading and traveling, and he just recently returned from a two-week trip from India. Besides writing, he also volunteers at the Glen Ellen Children's Resource Center program, as well as participating in a multitude of clubs at Hadley, including Best Buddies, Speech Team, and co-editor of Hadley's creative writing magazine, Mosaic. Welcome, Yusuf and Mr. Khan, and congratulations.
Yes.
Congratulations. Wonderful job.
Nice job.
Congratulations.
Yes, sir.
I have the pleasure of knowing your mom, Nazish, for many years, working with me on a couple of committees, one actually at the high school level, One's Nation. But I thought about a gift on behalf of the board that we could give to you, and although this isn't high tech, it's a cross pen. How many of you remember getting cross pens? But I thought it was appropriate because you'll be doing lots of reflecting and writing, and even though a lot of it will end up being typed, this is a way to remember that there's always time to take to put pen to paper to think. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, that is quite an honor. It's a great way to start the evening off with a bang. So thank you for being here, and thanks for everybody. We have presentations, reports, and initiative updates. I want to remind everybody that our meetings are now audio taped, and it's a fixed camera,
videotaped.
Thank you, and audio, video. And so board members remind ourselves to speak up, to be picked up, but then also any presenters will be presenting from the podium so that we can see you as well. And when we get to public participation, you'll be presenting from the podium as well. So I've got a little bit of feedback to raise the level of the volume a little bit. So thank you for doing that. Cool.
So tonight, Karen, Katie, staff members are going to be presenting to the board and the community on early childhood in the pre-K program. In the masses, trying to find people. So, Katie McCluskey.
Good evening, everyone. I just wanted to first start off by thanking the board for inviting us to come and present on our program. This evening, we're going to be presenting on the Baby and Me, the Partners in Learning, the early childhood, and the pre-K programs within our district. Our teachers are here this evening as well to help to present the information. So I also would like to thank them for collaborating on the presentation as well as spending the evening here with us to present the information. So with that, if the teachers want to come up, we'll do introductions and then start the presentation. If you want to just introduce yourself and then let them know what program you're a part of.
My name is Carol Montgomery Fade. I'm with the Baby and Me and the Partners in Learning program.
I'm Judy Laska. I'm with the Blended Preschool program.
I'm Jeanine Moulton. I'm with the Partners in Learning program.
I'm one of the Blended Classroom teachers.
Hi, I'm Megan Jarvis. I teach the bilingual class of preschoolers and the ESL class as well.
Hi, I'm Allie Orechkin, and I teach the Early Childhood Structure program.
And we're going to start the program off with Judy, so I'm going to go ahead and let them take it over.
So one of the things that we wanted to begin with is just research on early childhood education and the importance of that. And so we have some bullet points here that children learn more in the first 5 years of life than any other point in their lives. By giving children developmentally appropriate early childhood educational experiences and nurturing environments, it allows social, emotional, intellectual, and language development. The research, which was the high school Prairie preschool study, and I'll go into a little detail what that is. It's a study that actually started in the early 60s, and it took place and is still going in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And what they did is they took 123 high-risk African-American children, and they divided them into two different programs. One was a high-scope program, which was a developmentally appropriate early childhood program, and then the other ones that they put in a no program at all. And the study showed that that with this, and they are now still tracking these people, and you'll see on that 40 years from now, that they find out that 25% are less likely to drop out of school, 60% are more likely, if they don't have this, are 60% more likely not to attend college, and 70% more likely to be arrested with be arrested for a violent crime. So it just showed the importance of these children that were put in this program and what the children that didn't, and this is what they showed. And so again, they tracked these students up through the age of 40. And what they found, the children who had been in the program had higher earnings, were more likely to hold a job, and committed fewer crimes, and were more likely to have graduated from high school. And that's the thing. Children who have formal early childhood education experiences are more likely to graduate from high school than those who don't. Early childhood develops the whole child, and this means that in addition to the traditional skills like math and early reading, early childhood education helps them gain confidence and skills and helps them to be purpose members of society down the road. So.
So I'm going to be telling you about the next three slides, and I'll spend the most time on this one. So I just want to tell you that so you don't get nervous when I'm doing this. I'm just holding plate, all their stuff. But this one is relevant and pretty interesting because it is a study that the categories that I'll tell you about to compare are very similar to the kinds of programs that we have here in District 41. So it's just a very relevant study. They looked at, it was a researcher from Yale University and also the National Parents and Teachers Program, which in the early childhood world is very well known. It's a nationally known and very well-researched program. And they looked at 9,000 children to try to figure out, okay, so if they know that we know, it's pretty well researched, that school readiness predicts all those later things that Judy was mentioning. So they wanted to look at, well, what predicts school readiness? How can we get a kindergartner ready to learn coming in here rather than here? And so what they did is they followed 9,000 children from birth until age 5 or whenever they entered kindergarten and tracked what kinds of programs they were in. Were they in preschool? Were they in any sort of home visiting program? Were they... did they participate in any sort of parent education? And then, if so, what was the difference? And then, in addition, they looked at the data to look at children living in poverty and children above the poverty line. Because, as we know, the achievement gap, income, and children living in poverty is a large part of what makes up the risk factors that go into the achievement gap. So, I'm not going to tell you about all the parts, but I will show you that this top bar here in both categories is children who did not have any home visiting program or any preschool whatsoever. So of those children, children who were living in poverty, 64% of them arrived at kindergarten ready to learn. And how they had a whole scale where they determined what it means to be ready to learn, and it was a combination of academic skills that we might expect, like, can they understand that you can have a symbol mean something, you know, things like that, basic math skills, basic comprehension, but also the sort of social-emotional skills that go into being ready to learn, like can you delay gratification long enough to wait your turn, can you sit in a circle, can you walk in a line, you know, things like, all those sorts of things go into it. So they had a whole scale looking at that. So without any preschool whatsoever, 64% of children in poverty were considered ready to learn, and children, more affluent children, or at least out of poverty, 81%. Then the next line was, go back. I didn't mean that. Sorry. The next bar here is children who attended preschool. That's the red one. So just skip over that one for a sec. But the red one is children who attended preschool, and you see suddenly the impacts of preschool on both children in poverty and more affluent children. And then skip down again to the green bar on the bottom, and that is children who participated in a high-intensity home visiting program when they were birth to 3, plus preschool. And so that 82% children living in poverty, 93% children who are above the poverty line. So just to sort of let you know, we have, and then you can see there's sort of a gradation here. We have all these programs. We have some children who don't go to any preschool whatsoever. We try not to ever have that happen. We have children who only go to preschool. We have children, this next line in between is for a more general parenting program. We have that in the Partners in Learning. And then the last line would be children who go through all of our programs. They're in Baby and Me. They're in Partners in Learning. They go to preschool, and they arrive at preschool, 82% of them ready to learn, or 93% of them. Okay, now, next slide. Thank you. So the Baby and Me program is the birth to 3 component. It is that high-intensity home visiting program. And we use the Parents as Teachers curriculum. It's a very research-based, high-quality program. It aligns with early learning guidelines so that is what connects right up to the Common Core. So everything that's needed later, we're starting and at an early age, and we're educating the parents of what they need to be doing in order to have that happen. There are frequent home visits. There are developmental screenings. So if there's any need for any sort of additional look at the child to see if there's any something that can be done early to prevent any delays or prevent any delays from becoming a big issue that happens. We assess the family's strengths and what their goals are, and then we connect families with resources that can help them. So that a family that might be really struggling when they have a baby, they get stabilized. And then they almost sometimes, in some cases, look like a whole different family, a much, much stronger family. Life. Every year, the organization Parents as Teachers that we're using the curriculum, they do an assessment of our particular program. We're called an affiliate, and they give us a label. And we are considered a model affiliate because we meet, as you can see, we are a high-performing all of these areas are areas that are a part of the program we're required to do, and then this shows how well we did last year. So the first couple of bars are, did we, when we had new families and every year, did we assess what their needs are and set goals? Did families have goals that they met? The next couple, this one red one is if you have families who are not high risk, which we don't have any families in the program right now who are not high risk. So this next one, 94%, not quite 100. Of course, we want 100 in every area, but we did have a family with multiple children move before we were able to get in the required amount of visits and before we were able to complete the screening. So that's the other 94%. But just so that you know, the benchmark for a program is 60%. And that might seem like, whoa, that's a little low, but remember that we're talking about high-risk families. That's families with multiple risk factors, which tend to be difficult families to connect to and to keep in program. Our numbers illustrate the hard work and the very strong homeschool connection that we have. Okay, so next, that's Baby Me. Next up is Partners.
So, a little background on Partners in Learning. We've been around actually for over 18 years. It was originally started as the parent education component of the pre-K at risk program. Really, our main goal in Partners is really to empower parents as the child's first teacher, their most important teacher. Our program aims at building a strong homeschool connection, like Carol said, as the children enter preschool, kindergarten, and beyond. We want every child to have the tools they need to succeed in school. We found repeatedly that that's what their parents want, too. Our job as parent educators is to work with the families to really ensure they have everything they need, the skills, the tools, the support to promote success in education in their home. We do this through two different ways. One, we have a parent-child group or Partners in Learning class that meets one day a week. We have a morning and afternoon session, very much like a preschool class, only the parents stay, and they interact and they play. We focus on all these different areas of development, which fall right in line with the Illinois Early Learning Guidelines, which, as Carol also said, is right in line with the Common Core Standards. Our groups are great for the parents to really get that firsthand knowledge with the kids, how they're learning, how to support their learning. Our parents also have a really unique opportunity when they come to learn, share, and reflect with each other. And on many critical parenting issues and school issues as well. Our home visits are more of an individualized approach on that. We go into the homes. We offer one-on-one interaction with the parents, really help them with any concerns they have with the kids, really help them to just promote that growth and make it stronger, and again, build that connection. We've kind of looked just at the last 5 years, just the most recent, to just get a feel of how we've been doing. Over the past 5 years, we've served about 50 children per year through a combination of our groups and our home visiting. 74% of those families have stayed in our programs through kindergarten. that means that they probably had at least 2 to 3 years of that extra support before the kids started school. We decided we wanted to look a little more closely, and this is just very recently. We looked at 20 kids that had been through Partners in Learning that were entering kindergarten. And we wanted to know, okay, are they ready for school? We asked their preschool teachers that they exited from, and as you can see, 90% were ready for kindergarten language arts, 95% were ready in math, and 100% were ready in social-emotional development, which for us is a huge success. I mean, as everybody knows, the kiddos have to be ready in all of these areas to be successful. So that is the extent of our parent education program, and I think Brenda's going to share now with our early
childhood. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our blended preschool program. There are actually 4 sessions. Judy and I, Ms. Lisa and I teach the 2 different sections. And what we talk about in terms of a blending, that means it's a blending of all different kinds of children from all different backgrounds. It's up to 6 children who have special needs, and IEP, Intelligent Education, then another 20 children who are considered at risk for not being ready for kindergarten. So a lot of families that Janine and Carol already talked about would fall into this category. Then another 4 kiddos from the district, all over the district, who pay tuition to come into the program. So it's a blending of needs, a blending of abilities, blending of backgrounds, socioeconomic status. You've got it, we have it in the classroom. It's really, if you haven't had a chance to come take a look at it, it is an amazing experience. It is very difficult to pick out the 6 with the children with the IEP and the at-risk. It's very difficult when the classroom is moving because these children are all learning from each other. It's a situation that benefits all different groups of the children in the classroom. When we think about the children with IEPs, it really makes them step up their game. You know, they have to be able to learn from their peers. They have to be able to really regulate themselves, really focus on the things they need to do. It gives the children who have IEPs an opportunity to see typically developing peers and get instant feedback. You know, if you've got a kiddo, even a kiddo who doesn't have a lot of English, they can certainly say, I don't like that. And usually in my classroom, and Judy's classroom for sure, they will let them know, whether they say it or whether they just say thumbs down to them, to let them know, I don't like that. You gotta stop that, or I'm gonna go and play with somebody else. So talk about that opportunity for a child who's struggling with that social interaction to have that instant feedback right away. It's a really great opportunity for all kids to experience, but particularly the kids who struggle on that social-emotional level. When we talk about the kids who are either typically developing or those who are at risk, it also gives them an opportunity to assume leadership roles that they probably wouldn't have had before. They get a chance to help kids who may need help in other areas. You see kids helping each other within the classroom that I don't think would have happened if we didn't put all of these different kids with all these different needs together. It really lets everybody rise to the occasion. It also allows the opportunity for people to be very open to differences. It's a situation where the kids don't realize that skin color and hair color, we really, you know, talk about that and how that's different, but it's no big deal. It's just the way everybody's made. And that's a great opportunity to hit kids at 3.5. Because then they go into kindergarten from 2nd and 3rd thinking, hey, this is no big deal. It's okay if somebody has different color of skin. It's not a problem. So we're really opportunity to show to teach compassion and empathy, as well as realizing that everybody has gifts to share. You know, that whoever the child is, they have something to offer within the classroom. And the at-risk kiddos, they have an opportunity to figure out language, figure out English, figure out experiences that they may not have had before otherwise within this classroom. And share information and learn from each other. It also gives them an opportunity to catch up academically, socially, experientially. When we think also, we think about the classroom teachers. We have really highly trained classroom teachers who are providing these services. And it allows an opportunity to set up a classroom where kids are figuring out the social, emotional, how to be in school, I call it. What do you need to do to control yourself to be at circle and listen? How to be ready to learn? we're helping those kids really get ready to learn with that. Circle time, hallways, transitions, everything. You name it, we're addressing it within that class time. It's also helping with their social emotional skills. Sharing, taking turns, taking responsibility for your own self. All of these great things that our kindergarten teachers would say, oh my gosh, it's great when they have one when they come in and get to really consider them right.
I am lucky enough to teach two really special groups of kids that are pretty different. In the morning, I work with the bilingual students who are all native Spanish speakers. So in addition to the wonderful explanation that Brenda gave, my work is to educate them in Spanish as well as English to prepare them to roll into the dual kindergarten program. I have up to 20 students. They are also considered at risk and in need of a bilingual classroom set. My PM group is also considered at risk, and they are all English language learners. So that diversity piece that Brenda spoke of, that is rampant in my classroom, and I love it. I can speak English and Spanish, but I'm learning Urdu through the children. They're teaching me, and I'm teaching them. And like Brenda said, they're learning from each other. They're recognizing those differences, but it's not an obstacle to them. It's just something that they work together on to become better learners in school.
Hi, I'm Allie Rashkin, and I teach the Early Childhood Structured Program. So in my class, I have up to 7 children who are 3 through 5 years old, and my children all display characteristics of having autism. So each one of my 7 kids has an individualized education program, or an IEP, and they have identified needs for more intensive instruction in a highly structured environment, which is what I provide them. And then in comparison to the next slide, which is the self-contained program, Janet Silvestro is the teacher. She just didn't make it tonight. So her program has up to 10 students, all who are 3 to 5 years old as well, and they all have IEPs as well. Her kids have higher needs than the kids that have IEPs in Brenda and Judy's room, and my kids even have even higher needs than the kids in her classroom. So it's really a way for us to target the instruction so it's, we can individualize it at the kids' level.
Curriculum assessment. So really, we follow the same guidelines within the district in terms of reporting to families with a report card, trimester. We use something that's called Teaching Strategies Gold, and that is a nationally recognized. It's also a state board required. We have a list of assessment tools that we can use, and there's only a few, and this is one of them. And actually, one of, if you were to speak to somebody at ISB, they would say this is the one we want you to use. So that's the one we use. And it really looks at all areas of development, social, emotional, academic, everything. And we assess the kids through this trimester reporting with the families. We also report out for the children with IEPs, reporting out on those specific goals that they are addressing within the classroom. We are working very closely. It's very, very exciting. We've started this work really intensely over the summer and are continuing through this year, teaming with our math and literacy coaches. It is super exciting to really work on the curriculum within that. And all of our teaching is geared toward the early learning standards, which then tag into Common Core. So that's where we're headed. And that's the direction which we follow.
So, knowing that we were going to be presenting to you, we decided that we wanted to give you some statistical information. So, taking the Teaching Strategies Gold, we were able to review the data from 50 children that went to kindergarten. Teaching strategies changes every year, and so as the kids age out, you delete them out of the program. And I kind of got ahead of the ball and deleted my kids, put my new kids in before I knew we were going to do this. And so this is based off of Brenda and Megan's. But when we looked at it and I looked back on just data sheets that I had, my kids fall into this too. So we looked at 3 areas, social, emotional, literacy, and math. And so in social emotional, you can see that the kids' interactions with peers meets or exceeds what the learning standards outcomes are looking at, and making friends. And you have to realize that these kids come in at 3 and a 5, and they're still working on these social emotional things. For literacy, for knowledge of letter sounds, 96% of the children that went into kindergarten met or exceeded. 100% of the children that went to kindergarten were able to write their names. And 96% were able to write or convey meaning in some way. When you look at math, 90% were met or exceeded with counting. 60% were able to quantify. And 88% connect numbers to quantity, and 98% were able to extend or create patterns. So it was really interesting because part of being teachers and part of the professional learning communities is taking data and looking at it and meeting as a group. And what are you going to do when you see things like 60%? So Megan Jarvis and I actually had the opportunity to attend the Erickson Institute over the summer, and we attended a 4-day math conference. And it's so funny that this came up because this was quantification was one of the big things that they really, really hit hard on. And Megan and I are like, oh my gosh, we hadn't even done this yet, but we realized just going to the conference that this was a thing. And so that's where our PLC has really come around. And quantification, I mean, I'm sure you know, but just to explain this, being able to show a child a number of things and looking at it and going, without counting, I know that there's 3 there, I know that there's 5 there, I know that there's 1 there. And all that leads into being able to take sets, take them apart, which has more, which has less, and then down the road, being able to add and subtract. And so one of the things that we learned about was a wreck and wreck, and not only a 10 frame, but a 5 frame. And teaching these little kids to recognize at least 5. And that's what our activities have been. This week we're doing activities with dice, and it's not just taking dice, because dice are made up in a certain way. It's taking those dice and mixing them up. So on dice, 3 go this way. You take it and you mix it up so 3 go this way, and 3 go this way, to make sure that those kids can still look at it in a different form and be able to do that. And it's really interesting because we're taking data and seeing what our kids can do, and that helps us when we're in our PLCs to come up with those activities and work as a group to know that we're really working with these kids, so that next year, if we come back to present, the 60% is going to be up there where the rest of them are. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Questions?
The slideshow.
So this is just sharing with you some of the kids in action and the work that the teachers do on the daily.
Do you think we could stay in
For a second. You're not off the hook yet. That was a good move. That was a good move. But I know board members may have some questions for you.
So I will jump in and start and say that for a living, a lot of what I do is interview people. What I do, I ask them, tell me somebody who influenced you, who isn't a parent, and always a teacher comes up. So we know the teachers influence people. Well, based on the stats you're showing, you guys are sliding from influencing to life-saving, if you look at those early slides. So a concern I have is when you were saying some of the numbers, you were saying like 10 to 12 or, you know, something like that. I know that our demographics have shifted in the last 12, 13 years. Are we keeping up or are you turning people away?
We are absolutely turning people away.
You
always have a way. And we have a very thorough process to identify the 10 to 12 most at risk. But
there's probably a 13th and 14th and 15th.
Oh, absolutely. That could have been are pretty much, I mean, very, very close, yeah. Okay. So I think it would, I mean, in my opinion, it would benefit our whole district if we did increase our amount of families that we could take for that early service. We would see the payoff later on. Mm-hmm. And I do think it is less.
Other questions, comments?
Are there any students that are tuition paying?
Yeah,
four.
How many is that?
I think all that together in yeah. your class, and then another eight in mine.
So there's 16 altogether.
I have two students in my class already.
I forgot about
so 18.
So it was 18.
Yes.
How much? And I could have pulled the budget. I got lazy. What's the program cost?
I'll get that one for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, does that include the original grant that went away?
We don't have preschool grants anymore. The only grant that we have supports Baby and Me, the 0 to 3
no,
program.
No, I understand, but there was a grant and it supported the program, and we kept funding it. After the grant went away, it is part of these programs.
Yes. Yeah.
So it is part of these programs.
Yeah.
Okay.
And a couple more. Okay.
Sure.
If I saw the chart right, it looked like was so 74% went on to kindergarten. Did I get that number correct? Or did I miss that?
74% stayed in our program until kindergarten.
Till kindergarten. Okay.
Right. Okay. So you know, didn't kind of just drop out and then just go to kindergarten when it was time, mm-hmm. but 74% had stayed in our program thoroughly until they went to kindergarten. In fact, we actually have quite a few that
return as kindergartners. They're not ready to leave yet. And so, like, if they have kindergarten in the afternoon, they will insist their parents bring them in the morning, because I think both the parents and kids, they're not ready to let it go.
Okay. And that 74%, sorry, Kirk, just to, it's from baby and me all the way through that 74. Is it all the way through the continuum?
Yes.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure.
And we've just, doing this, actually, it was very useful for us to be seeing all the ways that we could continue to track students and be able to provide more accurate data over, because our students stay in, some I still see over at the high school even, you know. So we would be able to track students and their academic achievement and their other things if we would choose to. And
well, and that was going to lead to my next series of questions. Are we keeping track of how many kids, let's say, at grade points, maybe by fourth grade or eighth grade, how many started in this program, how many here? And I realize some people mm-hmm. move away, and that's probably the bulk of it. But that'll be the only reason why they can't drop out of school. But I was curious how many, and we may not have that number, but if we could even look for that mm-hmm. number at some point to go back and track the kids. And then do we have? I was impressed with the fact that you guys are assessing them. That's good. I like to see that. Do we have any way that, and this probably is not a question for you guys, it's probably within the program, but how are we taking a look at these kids as they go through our system and how they're actually to their peers, how they're performing? And maybe we have some national data that we can compare. I don't know if we're looking at that.
We haven't. This was our initial step in looking at data and kind of how our kids are doing, and then those are the next steps that Carol was just talking about. Mm-hmm. Now that we've seen this, we'd like to track the data further than just kindergarten and see how our kids are doing long term in our programs here in District 41.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to see that. I think that way we can see obviously there's value to the program. We can see what we're calling, what we're spending. Then I just had one last question. Mm-hmm. Have we evaluated, when we're looking at priorities, have we evaluated full-day kindergarten versus this program? What has a greater mm-hmm. impact? Obviously, I would think if we have both, that creates the greatest mm-hmm. impact. Mm-hmm. But as we're figuring out dollars and everything, have we looked at, in other words, if we eliminated this program, I'm not advocating that, but if we did, so for the press, not if we did though, because we had to prioritize full day kindergarten mm-hmm. and shift dollars, do we have an ability or an assessment or through other districts to see, are we losing anything? Does it stay the same? Do we gain anything? Mm-hmm. So I'd be curious to see what that would be too.
I just want to clarify. So do you mean like from a from the standpoint of building capacity for kids as they go into the kindergarten, first grade, etc.? So what does this do vis-a-vis someplace else or not doing it, etc.?
Okay. Right. I mean, Dr. Gordon had, mm-hmm. He indicated at one point that when research came out for full day kindergarten that there were huge benefits until, and then it seemed like leveling off at third grade, but that's the general population. So how do these kids that are at risk, how does that work for them? So I'd be curious to see.
Good question.
I think, aren't there about 80 kids enrolled in the preschool program?
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I was wondering is how many children do we have that don't get into preschool that we think qualify?
We always have a waiting list. There's 125.
Okay.
Is that how many are on the waiting list? No, currently, we probably have about 5 or 6 kids on the
waiting list. Because that may be something to take care of. The kids that, like, on the wait list, they don't get in, or the ones that get in, how are they, mm-hmm. performing once they get into school? And just, I'd be curious just to see the cost, too, just to see how it breaks down. But I think, to make sure I understand it correctly, the programs we're talking about, some of it we're required to provide by law. So I want to make sure everyone understands that. Like some of the kids with IEPs were required mm-hmm. to provide by law, and some of it we provide. I think, as Drew said, we used to get a grant. We no longer get a grant and have continued to provide it. But I'd be curious to see I think it would be good for the board to see, like, these are the costs of things that we have to provide. The kids that we have to provide school for, here's the cost for them. The kids that we've decided we're going to provide it. Because I think it's important to just break it down versus this is the total cost.
Okay.
Can I ask a follow-up on the wait list? You said there were five or six students on the wait list?
For pre-K, yeah.
For pre-K. So are they on the wait list because a parent came and put them on the wait list, or are they on the wait list because you evaluated them and said that they should be?
Yeah, both. And I would say if we, like, at this point in the year when I know that we're full, there's a lot of other children that we know who are out there, but because the wait list is full, I'm just going to remember them until the spring when we get them on. So it would be a different thing if we actually had more capacity. There are more children there, even than those five. But if those five, either their parent has put them on or through our sort of child find ability, we have put them on.
Okay.
Two other quick questions. The programs are all every day, or all the pre-sessions?
5 days a week, 2.5 hours each session.
Has there ever been any consideration ever been given to anything like a 2 or 3 day program so you could offer more if your kids were not reaching, that it could reach more? No, I don't want to. I'm not expecting an answer, but more just curiosity. Like if we have 3 and 2 day programs broken up by age, maybe we could reach more kids. Would that have a positive impact, or is that negative compared to these kids should be in their 5 days a week? So just
probably have to look for research for that.
Yeah, and then maybe that was it.
And Steph, I wonder if you could look at a 2 to 3. I mean, I wonder off of that if you could do if staff could look at a 2 to 3 day program. The cost analysis to that, and then offsetting that maybe for full day kindergarten to see again, do we lose anything if we then move those kids into full day kindergarten if they're getting less time early on, but they move to full day kindergarten? Does that equalize, or is that not a good thing? And again, just asking these questions so we can see.
I think you just also have to keep in mind that the less time kids are in school, the less. The less you're going to see in their progress. So you see as much progress as you see in our students because they do have school every day, 2 hours a day. So when you start cutting back, you're going to see less achievement in your students, and you just have to expect that because they're in school less time.
Well, true, but we could maybe get them in school by 5 years old, and then they'd be in longer. So that's, I'm trying to figure out ways. In a perfect world, if we had all the dollars, we'd love to have this full day kindergarten, but we have to start figuring out some ways on how to do that, and we can't do that unless we get those assessments to see, do we lose anything? And you're telling me off the top of your head that we would, but I'd like to see, are there programs out there doing it in that capacity, and are we losing anything in that database? So.
Carol, you talked about the programs that we're doing, and then in the blended pre-K program, is that a District 41 model, or is that one that's replicated nationally where you have the blended component?
You see it nationally, in terms of preschool, because there are so much growth opportunities within it for all kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, and just kind of following up on the model of, progress. Carol, the Baby ME program is a part of community outreach, which I work with. And I know that you told us a couple years ago that in the rubric that you use to identify, those kids that say, like, the 4 and 5 on the waiting list, are they sitting around not attending school? Are they doing some kind of program? And then what's the opportunity? Because we're talking about high-risk, at-risk kids, not, we have the wherewithal to put them in a different program because they didn't get in. Like, this is their opportunity.
This is. Without it, it's families who are, our families, our District 41 families, who are really, really struggling with finances. In large part. So to just think, they could go and pay even some preschool sliding scales, they can't. It's just too much. It's just not feasible. So no, they are not. I mean, they're at home with their parents. They're getting love. They're getting all of that, but they're not getting the kind of skills that that kindergarten expects. Mm-hmm. They're just not. So they would come behind. And we have a lot of anecdotal evidence. Years and years of anecdotal evidence from kindergarten and first grade teachers telling us, oh my gosh, I could tell which ones had been with you and which ones hadn't. But now we really need to get moving and start,
start really helping, because we do have the data, I believe, or we have ways to get it. Mm-hmm. And so this has been great, actually, all this focus on needing to quantify what we're doing, not just the anecdotal evidence that we have heard, I think is really going to help us down the road, and we'll answer some of these questions that I'm sorry we can't answer now, but we will be able to.
I have one last question that I forgot.
Sure.
Do you guys interact? It's not a forest fund, right? So how much interaction do you guys have with the rest of the population of school, or do you not have any interaction? Or how does that work out?
We do. We're a part of some of the assemblies. We actually have a partnership with fifth grade. They come every once in a while and interact with our kids when we're doing what we call center time. And what actually one of the slides showed the children working with a group of my children, and they were supposed to be creating nuts for the squirrels, and it had a number, and so they were helping them try to figure out how many and helping them make it. And so that's been wonderful. And the older kids, when they see our kids in the hallway, they'll wave at them because they have that relationship also.
And they come once a week, and that's the highlight of, I mean, my kids are always looking forward to Thursday when the big kids come.
Set you aside.
Can I just add one thing? Yeah. I moved over from Churchill with the bilingual program this year, and so my bilingual students are not privy to that Spanish-speaking community that is at Churchill, but I am finding that in other places at Forest Glen. So I'm finding, you know, fifth-grade students that are mentoring my three-year-olds that need a little direction on how to be in school, and it's nice for those kids that don't have that strong sense of Spanish-speaking community at Forest Glen. They're finding it in my classroom, so that's been something that's been really positive.
It's kind of a collateral benefit.
It really is.
That you didn't too.
So just a couple things. One, Katie, thank you for all your work. Gabby, for all of your work and the principals and the work behind the scenes that occur on a daily basis. And Katie, to your point around the research, even though you just mentioned it, your recommendation is based off of the countless research that you've done in this area. You're an expert in this field and feel very confident about what you're reporting out on based off those studies. But we'll get those studies to the board regarding time, its effectiveness, the more time. I appreciate all your work behind the scenes and your thoughtfulness there. Great presentation. I couldn't have talked about PLCs any better than you. That was a beautiful example of PLCs in action. So, one, thank you for participating in PLCs, Professional Learning Community. Sorry about the acronyms. You just really defined it, described it, and articulated the impact it has on educators, which ultimately has an impact on your kids. So,
exactly.
Huge kudos. Thank you all for presenting some very enlightening information, because I think most people have an understanding that we have a pre-K program in here, but most people don't understand about Baby and Me, all the family work that you do, your connections, and I love that. I love the question that Kurt asked around the consistency from 73% of our kids who start with us from that birth to kindergarten. That is, that's an impressive statistic. But thanks to each one of you for your work on a daily basis, because you do make a huge difference in the lives of families and our kids and other staff members. Huge job. Nice
Thank
job.
You. Thank you.
And here's your bonus. You don't need to stay. Yeah, please.
Oh. Do we get, not for them.
Okay.
Do we get yearly, like, preschool census or projection numbers? I know, I remember, like,
the I don't, I oh, thanks. Back here.
We get numbers who are coming out of early intervention.
Oh, I meant just, like, in general
no.
In the district, not just special.
No.
Special education.
No, we don't. Casarda would probably be the best one, you know, if we went back and looked at that. Or revamp that study.
There used to be a form that the district distributed to the preschools.
Okay.
That they distributed to the preschools.
Like, we did kind of a census.
Fill out, what age kids do you have at home? When are they going to be entering schools?
Years ago we did
that. I remember that.
I don't know if there was any value in that, but I guess I'm trying to figure out how to get it.
Oh, Nancy's answering your question.
Process to locate students in preschool who aren't affiliated with one of our families or anything. It doesn't keep track of kids who aren't preschools. It's a way of connecting preschools to us to get them enrolled.
But we do it through our registration process, or
it's like a step in the registration process. It's the first step we start before kindergarten registration. Our registrar reaches out to the local preschools, and I think some of the churches in the park district in the mall.
That's just incoming families. That's not really projecting like a couple of years down
the road. We don't keep track of who they have. Just who's coming to us. They're five and he's ready to go to kindergarten.
Okay. I think that would be helpful.
Yeah. I'll look into a little bit further with Nancy.
I just want to mention briefly for those who are watching us, there is a copy of this presentation on the website where you find the board agenda, so you can go in and click it and pull that out for you. Okay. Thank you.
So I just have a couple pieces on my superintendent reports, survey timeline, and board and community in the packet. There was an updated timeline and outline of each survey that we're going to be conducting. I'm not going to review each one of those, but just a quick highlight. The HumanX Culture Climate Survey, that's wrapped up, and we should be receiving that data in the coming weeks. The School Perception Staff Parent 4th through 8th Grade Student Survey will begin January 12th with staff and will conclude February 1st with students and parents. This data, along with the academic data, the teacher conversations, and other anecdotal data will be taken into consideration. So we really talk about those next steps with multi-age and other initiatives. I have said this decision will be made in late January, early February. Yes. But with the return, you know, with the conclusion of February 1st, that decision probably won't be made until late February. I just want to make sure that, because I really want to make sure that survey data is back. So I know early on I was talking about early January, February, but I just want to make sure that we're getting that data in. School Perceptions has enough time to get us the data back, so that's in front of us. So late February, early March. So I apologize for my earlier statements on it. I just want to clarify. And then that community survey will begin in early March, and that's that broader whole community survey. That's community members who don't have parents currently in our district, just that whole D41 boundary. That survey is still in the very early stages of development. And I'll update the board once we have more information on those. So in that topic, any board questions, comments?
I was just curious why the different timeline for the parents, students versus the teachers?
Just from School Perceptions. So what they've done in the past is just start staff one. And that's what we did the first time we started with the staff and then rolled it into the parent one. But that's based off of Bill Foster's recommendation.
And the community survey,
yes.
We originally had talked about doing it in May, but now to not over, what was the word you used?
I know.
Over-survey.
I remember it.
Survey fatigue.
Survey fatigue.
Talking about March, which is pretty close behind this, just wondering if it was a...
We can, did I say April?
I don't know.
Did you?
Because
the
parents would also be part of
the Yes, they
right.
would.
So
we talked about later.
So
because that survey wasn't because it was going to be more community based. That was not one that was. The board would certainly look at recommendations,
mm-hmm.
but the staff would not necessarily be adjusting or changing or modifying curriculum or anything like that based on that. I think that was more
okay. I apologize. So late April, that early May, mm-hmm. and I'll make sure that's. When we speak with Bill Foster again, that we'll put that in there. Because I think you're right. I think we did talk about
maybe
it.
Maybe.
Well.
Is there... check with Bill. Maybe there's a reason that, and you, in conversation, you adjusted it in terms of getting that
looking
back
for
before
my,
the academic year ends.
My friend back there... Did I just make up, Marge?
And no, you didn't make up.
Because
I so that we had some time before the end of the school.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
But I don't know if that's an absolute necessary piece.
We'll push that one back, and we'll talk with Bill, and then I'll bring that update again.
Because I'd be curious about if we do push it out, then we're getting it back into the summer, and it could have some bearing on, it could all impact some.
I'll bring that back at the next board meeting for the community survey one on what
their recommendation is on that.
And I wanted to have some discussion on, I know you've listed some topics here. I guess I have some other topics I would like to talk about. I don't know if now's appropriate or if you want to make it a discussion item for another meeting.
You know what, let's do that. I'll put it on if the board members want. Because it's already a pretty packed agenda, that if other board members are comfortable with that, we'll just put out the topics, and we'll go from there. If there are other topics, does that sound fair?
Yeah, other topics are good.
Yeah.
Questions about survey content in general.
Does that sound doable at the next agenda? Yep. Okay. Then PTA school visit. I apologize. No.
It was just the HumanX. Did we ask for those questions?
You did, and I'll give that to the board once once I get those.
Okay.
I don't have those questions yet.
Okay.
PTA school visits, updates, PTA visits. I've asked to be on all the upcoming PTAs meetings. Been able to attend a couple. By late November, I'll be able to have attended all of them. My school visits, this great term, or title we came up with, really original, Donuts with Dr. Gordon.
Yeah.
My wife keeps warning me each morning, like, only two, please. Only two. But overall, the visits have gone really well. Erica and the building principal, Erica Craviel, myself, building principal, at times assistant principal, sit down and we have great conversations with parents and really listen and really try to take in what parents are saying to us. The topics have ranged from multi-age, teacher specialization, our academic data, transportation, the elementary schedule, rigor at Hadley, PBLs, just to name a few topics. And really we're trying to take in information, also respond, try to answer some questions in the moment. Again, a big piece was that, where's that decision around multi-age? That's been a big topic of conversation that we've had, and that's why I wanted to make sure that I'm clarifying that again tonight. Hopefully by that late February, early March, that's when we'll have that piece due to getting that last survey in place. But they've been really good, very positive, respectful conversations, and what I appreciate, it's not about agreeing with me. It's about having a good open dialogue at each of the buildings, and parents have feeling good about being able to share with Erica, myself, the principal, different ideas, different concerns, different topics, different successes, because we've heard some successes as well. So I've really been pleased with that. We had a Franklin PTA meeting. Really appreciate the Franklin PTA. Kirk putting that together, where last Thursday night, it all kind of runs together for me anymore. We started with Donuts with Dr. Gordon in the morning, make sure we had our sugar fix. We had about 8-9 parents there, and then that night at 7 at Ben Franklin, we had roughly 18 parents show up to discuss many of those similar topics. We really honed in on multi-age teacher specialization, the academic data, those types of pieces. And again, any board members who were there, please jump in as well. Just a really good classroom size. Thank you. I was like, I knew there was a big one missing. There was like sitting there. I'm like, I know it's there. And kindergarten classroom size, to name a very specific one. So really good conversations. Kirk, and what I appreciated about the principals being there is a lot of those questions, principals are able to answer firsthand, that why, the rationale for some of those pieces. What we heard for the Franklin was around that kindergarten, we're going to need to look at funding another bus. So we have an AM and a PM bus. So we're not having to rely just on a morning bus that says, okay, we're going to have more kids in one section just due to busing. So we're going to have to make sure that we listen and make some actions to move that forward. And parents were fantastic about, now, I would make a different choice if I would have known this. If I would have known that this many students were in this kindergarten, I would have made a different choice. And it's hard. people's work schedules, all these different factors come into play. But I appreciate the honest conversation that we had at each of the buildings. So with that, I appreciate it. Hadley, I had a PTA meeting with Hadley. It was really about the Saturday Explore assessment, making sure parents had a little bit more time. One question, I was able to get on out of there. But overall, parents are really happy with their teachers, really happy with their schools. How do we continue to move forward? How do we continue to work together? That was also a theme. How do we work together? How do we all have that end goal in mind about kids. How do we ensure that our kids are ready for that next step in their lives through school? So I was pleased with it. And again, it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows. The people were really honest, giving me that feedback as to their thoughts, their perceptions on the district as it relates to any one of those topics. So I appreciate it. Board members?
I was at the Franklin PTA meeting, which I would agree with the sentiments. It was a positive conversation from the parents, and they truly respect their teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's some concerns and questions that came out of the meeting that we need to follow up with and even address with the board that I have some notes on here. And the first one actually came about because parents were expressing concern for the teachers at Franklin that are teaching in a grade that has an odd number of sections and are not specializing. And they're mm-hmm. teaching both subjects, literacy and STEAM, and they're managing two different classrooms of students, so about 50 students. So, there was some concern from parents that, how is this really the best way we can be handling this? And after the meeting, a parent mentioned to me that at Churchill, the teachers that do not specialize actually keep the same group of students with them all day. So I had sent Paul an email, and I think he sent the response to the whole board, which that was true. I verified that. And so what's concerning to me is that, if specialization is an initiative of the district, and I don't know, I know Forest Glen also has a similar situation, but I don't know how they handle it, so I'm not going to speak for Forest Glen. Lincoln does not have any odd number of sections. But if we only have four elementary schools in our district, and I don't understand how we're handling it inconsistently, and I want to make sure that we're handling it and having a positive impact on our students and our teachers. And the fact that the schools are handling it differently, I think somebody's probably not having the most positive experience. I know the suggestion was made by some of the Franklin parents that should we look at getting aides for the teachers at Franklin that are not specializing and having to manage 50 students because they actually have, a heavier load to manage than their counterparts because they're having to do planning time and PLCs with two subjects as well as manage 50 students. So that was one suggestion by one of the parents. Let's see. So I think, like I said, I'm just concerned, and I know I brought this up this summer. I actually had heard about Franklin having an uneven number of sections in second grade dropping down from 4 to 3, and so I brought it up. So I know it's an issue that we've been aware of. It's out there, and I just am questioning what is our priority. Is our priority for second graders to have two teachers? Is it for teachers to specialize? If teachers can't specialize, then should they just get the same students all day? Should specialization be an option? Because it's not happening for all of our students in our district. And the teachers, part of what I've heard about specialization, and I think it's I see it a little different. I see specialization in second and third grade a little bit different from fourth and fifth grade, just to be perfectly honest. I think in fourth and fifth grade I see how it makes a lot of sense, and I do have concerns about it for second and third, but that's not why I bring this issue up.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, I've even had the thought, if we didn't have specialization in second and third grade, which seems to be more developmentally appropriate, would it eliminate the need for an AB schedule? Would teachers be able to integrate subjects easier? Would it take away these issues where you have one teacher having to teach 50 different second graders and or third graders? So
This is one I think we need to figure out as a district. It's going to always be an issue. If specialization is what we're doing, we have got to figure this out. And I mean, are we going to have a subset of our students that always don't have a teacher that specializes? And how, you know, have we evaluated this has been happening for the past couple years. Have we evaluated, you know, how do the kids that have a teacher that don't specialize perform on tests? The kids that have a teacher that does specialize. I mean, I know it was a concern from the parents, and it's a concern for me. So I feel we need to have some.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the.
I don't know if Kirk or anyone else wants to chime in on that.
Well, I was going
to
say one of the questions that I had, because Stephanie called into a president meeting this morning and brought this up, and it's for me a part of it is the principals in those buildings. So it's a question of consistency versus being the same. I know we chatted a little bit about it. And the goal is to be as consistent as possible, knowing you're always going to have, it's not like a perfect number all the time. Certainly one response to that would be that the board would decide to fund another section in order to even that out. And that would lower class sizes maybe precipitously in some of the buildings, right? But that there's a cost associated with that, et cetera. But for me, part of it is, and I know that we'll get this through Dr. Gordon, but that the principals are getting that feedback and assessing that as they go, and it's that internal adjustments that you need to make all the time. But it's there's certainly antidotes to do it, and it's adding that section or doing something like that. But we need to hear.
Well, that was another suggestion from a parent to add a section, but I'm not talking about. You know, adding a section, I'm talking about what is our philosophy? How are we going to approach this? If we have an odd number of sections, I think we need to handle it consistently.
What's the methodology?
Because I can tell you, you know, the parents who have kids struggling right now at Franklin are like, I wish my kid was at Churchill because they could have one teacher all day long because they have the same situation there and they have one teacher teaching the same class all day long. And so I think there's frustration when we see things happening differently at different schools. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to bet, you know, the Churchill parents probably don't have the same frustration because they have a little more consistency mm-hmm. there with how that's handled. It's, you know, they have one teacher. So mm-hmm. I think there's different experiences happening mm-hmm. at the different schools.
So, Paul, how's those different experiences by the teachers get discussed?
Principal, teacher, having those conversations.
The principal, the superintendent.
At team meetings, and having those conversations. So we'll keep
come together as a
and how to
group and PLC principals.
PLC principals, yes, PLC principals. And we talk about it, you know, how does that work when we do have odd sections? Where does it fit? And really bringing back to our principals, having those conversations at the school level with the teachers about how do we best make this work without, as what you said, lowering those class sizes, you know, something like 12 to 15 for a grade level. How do we apply the work? And as you mentioned, Ben Franklin, having those conversations with teachers, having the conversations over at Churchill with the teachers about how do we best make this apply. But we can add that to a future board meeting around teacher specialization, around that philosophy. How do we continue to have those conversations? And recognizing that under board policy, principals, that's one of their directives, is to ensure that those classes, along with teachers and others, that they're ultimately responsible for that, to ensure that piece is working on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not faulting the principals for this, because honestly, I see this as this was the directive that came from the board, and you know mm-hmm. they're trying to carry it out, and you know every building operates differently. But if the board is giving the direction that teacher specialization is where we're going, then we need to give the direction on how we handle the odd number of sections. I don't mm-hmm. think that responsibility should fall with the principals, because I think if it's the directive coming from here. I don't see.
Well, it may be ultimately that the board supports the model, but the management of that happens in the building. And if, you know, this came up at Franklin, and I thought it was a really good conversation. Steph and I were both at the donut meeting last week, right? And that the question came up, and I think, you know, Kirk, you said this, you know, if you're looking at your child and you have an issue, it's go to the teacher first. That's always our line of first you know, defenses. What's going on? You know best. And then I know you said also, and then come to me. It's really up the chain of command, and you know, Mr. Burke, Jeff also with that. And it was, I think, a good reminder of exactly what you're saying, Stephanie, and that is how in the building are you managing that piece. And it's ultimately the management internally, and it's, you know, commitment to the model, you know, for that.
It's interesting to me. I mean, you know, you go to McDonald's in Los Angeles or Chicago, when you study them, they want the burger to taste the same. So that's in a multi-billion dollar company. We have four schools here, and these four schools, you know, there's some autonomy with certain things. How do you celebrate Halloween, the traditions they have? What do their fifth graders do? Those kinds of things are important to the school culture. But when it comes down to the small school district that we have, a child at Churchill should be getting the same educational benefit, the same educational avenues as a child at Franklin or Lincoln. This, to me, is not really that difficult, and it should not be left up to the principals. The board made a direction. And the thing that's frustrating to me is there were people 3 years ago, forward-thinking people, that sat in the audience and told the board and told the staff at that time these issues were going to come up. So we're 3 years later. We're still inconsistent. We still have not come up with a plan. I was frustrated with some of the responses because, you know, enrollment came up with Franklin. You know, Stephanie talked about enrollment a month ago. And, you know, we've got Dr. Gordon kind of, you know, acting as if, well, I'm not sure if we've talked about it, thought about it. I don't know if he had or not, but I know that it had been brought up by this board a month ago. And, you know, within a month, we should have had a response for the parents of Ben Franklin regarding that. What are we going to do? And, you know, we always say we're going to talk as a principal and as a team. And, you know, that to me is just education speak. At some point, you're talking and you're solving problems. And, you know, we need to start solving some problems around here. So that's where I'm at with this whole thing. It's a frustration I have. I think our customer, the parents, are frustrated the same way that I am. And, you know, to give these answers that, you know, well, we leave it up to management. We're leaving it up to management. But management's not giving us answers. Or they're answers that, I'm sorry, I don't want to be told I don't understand the answer. I understand the answer. And I may not like the answer, but I know we can do better. So we need to start doing better with some of the stuff. And it that absolutely relies on management. And it falls on management.
To add to the enrollment discussion, I was going to mention that enrollment was brought up, and I had talked about it a few weeks ago, and I think the two big things were too many children in kindergarten classes and many classes over the target limits. And the answer last week to the parents was, well, we're monitoring it, which I guess goes back to myself and, you know, my frustration. I'm concerned about having 25 students in kindergarten classes and making some decisions there, but thing I wanted to mention here is that a parent had mentioned to me that there's other school districts that have policies that say if the class goes one student over the target, that an aide is added to the classroom. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily saying that we should have that sort of policy, but I think we need to better define how we're going to manage this, if this is going to continue to be an issue, if we're going to have space issues or whatnot. But I you know, this is another one that I think that we're setting the targets. We need to set, well, what's going to happen if we go over the targets, mm-hmm. and not be putting the burden on, you know, the staff to come, you know, to have to come begging for help. I think if we set the targets, they're set for a reason. So just another thing I'm putting on the list, I think still needs talked about.
But the part of management of that is management should be coming back to us and saying, look, we're over the targets here. And we can say monitoring it. I look at monitoring, and I'm sorry, this is not to be this. Monitoring to me just means monitoring it, and we're not going to do anything about it because we've gone a month and we haven't done anything about it. Now, monitoring it maybe was the principals felt it was okay. Maybe that's how they felt, but obviously we've heard, you know, especially Ben Franklin, that the parents don't feel that that's an adequate response. They want something done or they want a solution. And so for us to continue to say monitor, it's up to management to say, okay, you guys set the target, but here's some issues. I mean, Dr. Gordon did say, as a solution, maybe we can look at adding a bus. You know, now I wouldn't necessarily agree with that because I heard parents say, as another solution, can't we just send an email to all the parents and say, AM has 25 kids, PM has 18 kids. Is there anybody on the AM side that would switch? And I heard parents say, you know what, I would do that. That would cost nothing. That would cost nothing. $0, and we'd have a couple of parents say, you know, it's probably not ideal for me, but I'll switch them over. You know, can't we? That's just common courtesy, I would think, as a principal to send that out. But yet we don't do that, and then once again we make a decision, and then we almost act shocked when parents are saying to us, "Well, we're upset because there's 25 kids." So, you know.
I don't think anybody was shocked. I wasn't shocked. I wasn't.
Although we should have a solution. If we're not shocked, we should be developing a solution to give to them at this point. I'm sorry, saying we're monitoring it, that's an easy, I used to say to my mom, I'm going to get to it, I'm going to read it.
Okay. Can I ask her what's the outcome? Because there's a an outcome to these meetings, certainly. I mean, Kirk and Jeff have been at these meetings, so.
You have my outcome.
I just wanted to bring up meetings, or topics that I felt the board needed further discussion on. So specialization was one, the enrollment was one. Null page was talked about a lot. I think that one, that's still up in the air a lot. But I know a really good point was, you know, part of the concern is the appropriateness of second and third being multi-age together. And if we do move forward with that, what are we doing for preparedness, for truly preparing our teachers, if we decide to go forward with that. So just mentioning that because I thought that was a really good point mentioned by a parent. One thing that I wanted to say, and it was brought up at Franklin, was that we're growing. And I keep a response to one of the parents is that we're growing. We're still growing. Data is improving. And my notes on that is we have seen growth in the district and areas. So we have. But the data does not conclusively support a blanket statement that every age, every grade, we are growing. And I looked through our academic update, and I asked for some more information on that. I was looking at ISAT scores. And so, you know, I have some ideas and data that I think we truly need to be looking at further. And I don't like that blanket statement because I feel like it's misleading. I mean, if you look back at our ISAT scores in 2014, we actually declined. We did not grow. So I don't like hearing that, and I guess I would like to suggest that we, some of my ideas for data, we could discuss at a future meeting. Doesn't have to be now. Mm-hmm.
And I think your point about the 2-3, and Paul has mentioned this, that with the survey timelines, and those were set last year, and so now that we're rolling those out, that piece of that is going to become more, I think, defined. We're gonna see that information, and then there's gonna be that piece. And I know, Paul, we had also talked about you continuing to get into the buildings and doing one-on-ones, well, not one-on-ones, but small groups with teachers, and that was a big piece of what you and Karen did last year in order to gather that data. That was a board directive to you, and your goals is getting into the buildings in order to do that. So I think that continues to be crucial. I mean, and to your point is that it's both, and it's the hard data, but also those conversations that lead to decision making, et cetera. So,
but it's very dangerous to say, well, we're growing, everything's getting better. I don't
heard,
think that's
heard,
accurate.
We heard it.
As far as the survey goes, I want to point out there were two board members here that had to push very aggressively to get those surveys. So when we act as if a board, like we were happy to get these surveys, and there would be no survey this year of the parents without the public.
That's false. That's absolutely false. Let's just make sure. It was on schedule even 18 months ago. It was said that.
It's not false.
You asked
both of us to go ahead and put the survey, and we gave a presentation for survey. We were pushed back aggressively. People can go ahead and listen to it. Okay. So when we act like we care about what people think, there are some here that care about what people think.
I think this whole board cares.
Just a couple of points about the Ben Franklin meeting. The first thing, just in response to Kurt, I think that when you guys brought this up in May, we talked about doing the survey 18 months after. We can disagree. That's what we talked about. And like you said, you can go to the audio, not the video, but the audio to see that, or hear that, I should say. So I think I concur with Paul's response to that, just for the record. One thing that I got out of the Ben Franklin PTA. I thought it was a great experience. I think it's new, and with it comes information, feedback. It's a two-way street. It's not just us putting District Digest out, but you're actually getting this information, and that's the increased communication that the board was looking for. Mm-hmm. I think it's very positive. I think the donuts with Dr. Gordon was kind of what came out of that, but I think after being at the PTA meeting back in September at Ben Franklin, what came out of that meeting was that there was a request for you to go out at PTA meetings, which you're doing now. And I think that is an improvement in communication. I do think there were four board members there. I counted 17 parents, but glad I counted Patrick as one of each.
Yeah.
Board meetings, that's
me too.
And I concur with some of what Stephanie said about her, you know, the pushback on some of the items. Mm-hmm. I also think, you know, Dr. Gordon did give fuller answers to the data than just a blanket statement. You talked about whiskers. You talked about where the data is located for people to interpret it themselves, because it is data after all. So it's not that there wasn't a broad statement said by you, but you also gave detail behind it. So that was a good meeting. It was well run by the president, Katie Prescott, and stayed on task and, you know, lead the hopefully more meetings in the future.
Yeah, Paul, I was there, and I wanted to definitely I wanted to give my feedback. Like I said, I was there listening as a dad, not really a board member. And what I was hearing a principal telling me, you know, and I wrote some notes here, and I thought that was good. You know, the proactive school districts, you know, we question validating the teaching model when you look at these things. And you know, I have two kids, and I had got their math data, and you know, he's reaffirming that we don't look at math data singly, but multiple points. And he kept one of the things that Kirk kept using. He kept using the conversation we, and it supports the building philosophy that it's a building decision. So you just don't say we off the cuff if you truly don't believe in it. So. Staff and teachers believe in PBLs, and some of the staff's, you know, the nonverbal body language, you could see him, you know, shaking their heads yes when he was speaking to some of this stuff. And one of the things that I did write, and I had to leave when we started to go into the fine PTA stuff, but one of the points that I heard that I kind of took a lot of, I wrote down was, you know, it was more of the scope of the dialogue and the changes that happen at the school, not the changes of themselves that they have questions about. So I heard, you know, I like what we're doing. Just tell me more how we're doing it. Mm-hmm. So I was sitting there listening and 17 people, and it's just constant information of how the programs are going. So I thought, Kirk, you did an excellent job at that meeting. Thank you.
Yeah. We have one.
Just to add to that, I mean, I think the Ben Franklin parents were some smart parents at that meeting, and I think they're very respectful with how they were asking questions. But there were a lot of questions asked. I don't want to walk away from this with this impression that we just wanted to understand, and everybody walked out of that meeting.
Even in the morning,
I stayed in the library for an hour and a half after the meeting with parents asking me more questions. So I think, you know, I think there are a lot of questions, and we owe it to the parents to follow up and truly answer them as a district, because a lot of the things they have questions about, I mean, it's not necessarily coming from the leadership of their building or even their teachers. It's coming from what we're doing as a district, and I think we owe it to that school, to all the schools, to truly vet these issues. And I think they do have a lot of respect for their school, and that wasn't the concerns that were being brought forward. And you know, another point I had, it kind of goes with the preschool presentation we just saw. They talked about partners in learning, talked about literacy, math, and social emotional. And we've talked a lot about data, but I'm just curious. I know we hired an outside consultant to come work with staff at our schools when we've had issues and concerns with going on in our elementary schools. Like, I don't know if it was a psychologist or what, but
have we hired an outside consultant, someone outside of our district with a who has no opinion about what we're doing to actually look at what's going on in our elementary school, someone without a vested interest, to just give us some evaluation to how socially and emotionally what's happening, especially this year. I think I've heard a lot more social and emotional concerns to get that data as well to look at.
I was just going to add, it's interesting, and I'm not sure what, maybe Joe can clarify when you said it's new. I don't believe that anything that I heard of Ben Franklin was new.
I meant new that Dr. Doherty is going
gotcha.
To meet.
Okay, gotcha. I got you. That's why I want to clarify that. Because these issues have been talked about at Lincoln, and I can assure everyone here, I do not walk the halls of Ben Franklin. So very few people know me there. So I'm not creating this, but this is coming from them organically. So
maybe one wrap-up, and this was a takeaway from the morning. I know you have a Dr. Gordon, a donuts with Dr. Gordon at Hadley.
Correct.
Coming up. That's next week.
It's Wednesday.
Yeah. Oh, this Wednesday.
This Wednesday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Clarify that.
Very much.
So know that, again, if you can't make it to another school, if you haven't been able to go to one, you can certainly go to one at the other school, so you're welcome to do that. But one closure, and we'll move on, is that I think a takeaway from the morning donut was a really good comment from a parent who said, parents don't evaluate the superintendent or the principals, it's not our job, you know, but one of the rating approaches is their passion, is there, and it speaks to what you're saying, Stephanie, which is that the buildings are, focusing on these things, and it's really important to them to be able to work together. And I know that that's, when we're at CIT, I hear that from the principals as well. But I think the wraparound to me is something that was kind of underneath it, which is to get to the why. The how and the what are rolling, but what is the why? And I think that's a hard, that's a really important question to answer, and we don't go there well enough often. But I think if we answered the why, that some of this, and maybe Patrick, this is a little bit of what you're saying, would be revealed and then changed, stopped, paused, focused on whatever it might be. But that piece is critical. So thank you for all the feedback, everybody.
To add to that, I know that the father that said that, I think that was a great point, and the mm-hmm. one thing he said was that, he challenged the administrators of our school district to see if we have overcomplicated the schools to the point that it's affecting our school day.
Yeah, he talked about pace. Yeah, who
children.
Sets the pace.
So I think that's, the other part of that that I thought was an excellent question. So
he asked a great question about what sets the pace, and it's certainly the standards and Common Core and those things that are out there for children to have to achieve. That's the measure that we're dealing with. Well, thanks for all the feedback. If you can get to Hadley on Wednesday, please do that. Let's see. That's it. Okay. Public participation. When you come in, there's some forms. If you haven't grabbed one and you want to provide public comment, please grab one and complete that. I'd like to remind members of the audience that speakers should identify themselves, complete a public participation form, limit your comments to 3 minutes. If your comments have substantially been reflected in others, we'd ask that you please forego making them, but please provide the board any copies of written material that you have may have. And that's just in general. If you have information or something you want the board to read, please give it to Mrs. Moak, and she'll make sure that we get a copy of that. Personal complaints and criticism about staff members, students, or other members of the District 41 community should be initiated privately with the appropriate district representative. Profanity, interruption, and or other interference with the orderly conduct of the meeting are not permitted. All questions raised will be forwarded to the appropriate D41 staff representative for a response as a response is warranted. Mrs. Moak, is there anyone that would like to present to the board?
Jeff Cooper.
Good evening. And again, remember the mics are up this way, so if you can speak up. Yes.
I know what happened on the assistant principal issue. At least two of you know what happened, know how what happened did happen. But it's pretty clear that the Cubs will win a World Series before I get a straight answer on this subject from the board president. Sure, the Daily Herald are certainly picking up the ball on this. It leaves me with asking questions of one person. Dr. Gordon. On that paper that you gave me about a year ago titled Assistant Principal Cost Repurposing, it says to fund the second position, et cetera, et cetera, about how $100,000 was moved from one fund to another fund to cover the salary. So, to Dr. Gordon, since you were new to the district on July 1st, 2013, you probably didn't initiate such a move on your own. But your paper said the administration made the decision to reallocate. Can you please expand on this? Were you given direction by Cicerello, Reebok, one or more of the board members? Your stakeholders deserve the truth. We know who's not telling it. We hope that you'll stand up on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper.
Can I just want to add that quick. I know I had asked at the last meeting to talk about the assistant principal situation, and I just wanted to mention that. I talked with Mrs. Nelson, as she suggested, and I fundamentally...
And Paul, both of you.
I have some disagreement with how the AP situation was handled, but I understand the explanation that was given, and my understanding moving forward is that staff positions are to be reviewed and approved every year on the budget, so... That's what I just wanted to add that since I brought it up.
Thank you. So. Thanks. Mrs. Mill?
Tina Cardona. Hello.
Hi.
Tina Cardona. I just wanted to clarify, just so you all clearly understand, I'm one of the vice presidents of the PTA at Franklin, and I just wanted to reiterate that there is by no means anyone at Franklin that doesn't appreciate Mr. Samples and Mr. Burke. We all feel very strongly that we have an incredible support system with both of them, and their doors are open consistently, and there's no hesitation from anyone that I've experienced to go in and speak with them. The reason why there's an abundance of conversation at Franklin is if you look back at the changes that have happened in District 41, the current fourth graders, and you count back year to year to year, these guys were kindergartners, and from their kindergarten experience to their fourth grade experience, I believe it's 8 different adjustments that have been made to curriculum. So you have a pulse, a growing pulse with the fourth grade parents. And that this is why there's such conversation happening right now. And it's not just because parents are upset that there's change, it's the feedback we're getting from our children. We have kids who don't want to go to school. We have kids that cry at night to go to bed. And it's the truth. So I just wanted to make sure you clearly understood that it's not something that we don't feel comfortable talking to our administration about, but this is where it's coming from. This is where it's originating from. And then when you look at the second graders, we're not going to miraculously get 25 more second graders. So continuing forward, there will always be a trio here that we definitely need to address. A fourth grader and a second grader. So this is very much within the four walls of my home every day. So I just want to make sure y'all clearly kind of understood where we were coming from.
Thank you, Tina.
Amy Kaminsky.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the special education. And I found it was a great presentation that the ladies gave. And I thought it was very interesting that they talked about how the blended program was a learning experience and a teaching environment for both the at-risk kids, the tuition-paying students, as well as the special education kids, and that every group was learning just as much from the others. And I would ask that the board consider what they're typically developing students that are in kindergarten and beyond might be able to learn from our special ed students. That right now we have them in a self-contained classroom, and I understand that they spend time. I have a daughter with special needs, so I kind of know this. I understand that they do specials, so art and gym, which is great that they have some time with the gen ed population. But I think that what I like to teach my family is that we do not live in a special ed world. My daughter is not going to live in a self-contained world. She needs to learn how to interact with typical peers day in and day out. And I think the place she can learn so many of those skills right now is in a classroom, because that's where she spends most of her day. And I would like to see her spend more and more time in a gen ed classroom. I think she has a lot that she could offer those students, and I think that she could probably learn. We could even raise our expectations for her even higher than they are, and she could learn more just by being around those typical children. We might show her or teach her things that the teachers, not that they can't or won't, but that's just not part of the structure of their day.
Mm-hmm.
So I just ask that the board consider that for those of us who have children that are self-contained, that they really need to be part of one hour. So, thank you.
Amy, you're a parent at Ben Franklin?
I'm sorry, no, she's a... I'm a Lincoln mom,
okay.
But she goes to Ben Franklin.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Lisa Brooks?
Hi, I'm Lisa Brooks. It's nice to tag along with yours. Last week you visited Churchill to spend time in the classroom learning about the day in the life of a District 41 student in second grade. I'm wondering if you have or if you have plans to do the same thing, to visit our special ed rooms, either our self-contained classrooms or students, spend time shadowing students who are in general ed classroom but receive resource report support. Because I think that would be wonderful. So not only can you see the day in the life of a typical District 41 student, but also a day in the life of a different learner in District 41. So if you don't have plans, I would
love to have plans.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mrs. Mo, anybody?
That's it.
No? All right. Thanks very much. Thank you, everybody, very much. All right, discussion items.
Special ed.
Perfect.
Into that theme of special education tonight, that process. Tonight is a report that Karen and Michelle will be giving to us. This is information only. They'll give the board a summary of the report and then address some questions that board members have asked about special education in the past. With that, I'll hand it off to Karen and Michelle.
Sorry,
No, you're good.
Mm-hmm. So, again, I'm Karen Carlson, Superintendent for Teaching and Accountability, and this is Gavel, our Director of Student Services. So, in the board report that you have in front of you, we kind of highlighted general information, kind of like what is an IEP, kind of the types of programs we have in District 41, number of students in those programs, as well as their locations and then just general funding sources as well. So Michelle and I then just kind of want to add some additional information, kind of some questions we've kind of heard over time and things like that. And I'm going to start and talk a little bit about kind of the history around the locations of our programs. And this is my 10th year in the district, so I can kind of speak to the last 10 years in that. But obviously, you know, we only have four elementary schools. And so each of our elementary schools sort of had a unique student population, and we try to consider that. Not obviously, facilities is one of those factors, kind of room and things like that. So historically, I'm talking just kind of the past 10 years and that. Churchill had the predominant English-speaking population, so they had the bilingual program and now dual. Forest Glen has had the early childhood program for a number of years. One of our K-1 self-contained programs used to be there, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when I get to Franklin. Lincoln School had the refugee student population, which brought unique needs and things like that for that building. And then at Franklin, it was the self-contained program. And originally they had two sections, and we had an opportunity at one point, kind of due to space that was available in the building, to move the K-1 program from Forest Glen over to Franklin to give those kids kind of a continuous K-5 experience, even though they started out, many of them, in early childhood. And so we do look at some of those factors. Early childhood makes sense at Forest Glen. It is all of the buildings. They have a number of classrooms that have the bathrooms and that. I know Jackie and Stephanie are here. Those were former kindergarten rooms, but it made more sense for the childhood kids to have those so we could switch those rooms up. Lincoln is not terribly handicapped accessible, so it's tough to put some of the self-contained programs there. Even though Franklin, though, is two stories, they are more handicapped accessible. So that was kind of the original thinking. Obviously, we know that Lincoln has lost that significant number of refugee students, so that doesn't have that same level of impact. But I just kind of wanted to clarify kind of why the programs are where they are at. And every program has unique needs that can sometimes feel like it adds to teacher responsibilities, things like that, you know, whether it's a significant number of ESL students, some of those things. So we just kind of try to balance that among it. Obviously, Hadley, one junior high, they get everything. Nowhere else to put them in that. So that's kind of the reason behind kind of some of the location decisions that we had made over time. And then Michelle's going to talk a little bit kind of about the process we went through for our students who returned to the district and a little bit about funding as well.
I just wanted to thank the board again for the opportunity to speak today. My passion is special ed, so when I have an opportunity to discuss special ed, I appreciate that. So thank you. It's been, now that this is my second year, it's been a pleasure getting to work with our fantastic teachers, and I've really enjoyed getting to know our students more and more. They're such wonderful kiddos. So, as we reported last year, we brought back six students from case member districts back into district programs. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the process that was involved with that. Many of the conversations began within the case directors and the case administration. And then from those conversations, then I came back and met with the building administration and district administration to collaborate with them, get their feedback, share what our conversations were. Those discussions continued, and ultimately it was decided that we would look at being more inclusive and trying to meet students' needs in a less restrictive environment and within the home district as much as possible. I shared those conversations along the way, like I said, with all the building administrators, and I met with Franklin administration a little bit more heavily since they housed our self-contained programs, and met with the Franklin teachers as well to collaborate with them about what kind of things would be needed. As early as November of last year, we did some observations of the students. I involved some of the Franklin staff in that and did some observations. I attended each student's IEP meeting. Some Franklin staff attended IEP meetings so that what kind of things would we need so that we were prepared so that this would be a really good transition for our students. And then finally in May, we invited all of the students and their parents into Franklin to do like a little meet and greet, see this building, take a tour, meet the staff, answer questions. So that we wanted to make this a really nice transition for our students. And I just wanted to highlight transitioning to a less restrictive environment or to a more restrictive environment is continually happening within the IEP process. It's just part of the day-to-day of what we do in special ed. There's transitions all the time. So although this one transition was kind of highlighted to it, in reality, we're doing this every day in special ed. In addition, questions came up regarding whether or not the district had decreased special ed funding or our special ed budget. So I just wanted to clarify that LEA, the district, has MOLE requirements, maintenance of effort requirements. I know I talked a little bit about that, I think, last year, but I just wanted to talk a little bit more in depth about what MOLE is, what our maintenance of effort is. The purpose of the requirement is to ensure the districts provide financial support necessary to provide our students with a free and appropriate public education, those students who are eligible under IDEA. So in general, districts cannot reduce the amount of local or state and local funds that we spend on the education of children with disabilities. In order for a district to be eligible for our IDEA flow through funds, the state government determines that have we budgeted at least the same amount of local or state and local funds
that we spent, that we actually spent on the education of children the last school year. And we are prohibited from reducing that level of expenditures for the education of children in the preceding year. So in other words, we must maintain an increase in the amount of local or state and local funds, or at least not decrease that amount, stay consistent with that in the preceding fiscal year. And that's all monitored. That's how, if we did not meet that maintenance of effort, we wouldn't get our IDEA grant, which is about $700,000. So of course we would want to make sure that we get those funds.
Can I ask a No, thank you. And I had pulled out my report from last year, the PowerPoint that you guys did, just to see. Well, that was your first year here, actually, so this is your second year. And I guess I have a question related to something you just said, which is the reality that, you know, as your teachers and aides are working with the children and there's this movement kind of in and out of least restrictive, is there a projection at some point where you see children moving into some of what a parent just talked about, which is a more more often with typically, you know, versus whatever. Like, is there something you see now that you're in a second year? You've been through a whole cycle with our children. Our numbers are higher. Last year we had 386 children with IEPs. This year we have 414. So what's the projection around that, or how do you...
To know if students are in
Yeah. Yeah.
So the federal government refers to that as educational environment, or EE codes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do monitor that to make sure that we have it. You want to have about 60% or more of your students in EE code 1. And I think that we are there. Our EE codes actually look pretty good. But it is something that I think probably all the staff in the building or in the room that work with me, I always say our students are Gen Ed students first. And so that's a big part of how I am as a special ed leader, that I want to always remind everyone our students are Gen Ed students first. So what does that mean? And so that we're always considering what kind of equal opportunities and making sure that our students do have, are considered Gen Ed students first. So what does that mean as far as their educational portion of their day, social, emotionally, participation in activities.
Mm-hmm. What accounted for the jump, the numbers? Because that's a shift. I know we had six children come back in, which I know their parents were thrilled about and excited about.
You know, the number of students with IEPs is kind of a fluid number. Mm-hmm. It moves probably around that number all the time. So if I pull the numbers today, it might be different than when I pulled them yesterday, based on move-ins or new students who are eligible or students who are not eligible. So, I mean, it doesn't jump by a lot, but I think it's remained pretty consistent around that 400 number.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
When you guys are talking about this, we always use the acronym IEP. Do you use that as a catch-all for IEP and AEP and all of the statements that you're making, state funding and all of that other stuff? Should I consider those two?
IDEA.
So IDEA is the federal grant for specialized education. I'm sorry, IDEA is the legislation that governs special education. And an IEP is an individual education program.
Right. But when you talk about IEP, you use the IEP a lot in your presentation. You didn't touch a lot of AIP.
The programming itself.
Okay.
No, that's good. That's a good. Yeah.
Okay. So the program, those terms are not federally mandated terms. Those were just terms.
Yeah, but I was just saying, like in our conversations tonight.
Right. Because it's referenced in the report.
Right.
And those have typically been case programs. So if we have students who had, if you can agree, that really profound intellectual impairment,
In cases that are cooperative.
And kind of what I shared last year, those MIP, instructional, AIP, all of those terms in general, there is a lot of confusion around them. And so as a co-op, we're trying to eliminate some of that confusion by slowly eliminating some of those terms, because really, what does that mean? And they're not consistent. If you were to go to a school district outside of CASE,
right.
they would refer
right,
to it in
right,
a different
right.
way.
Right.
So.
The comment you made about the budget, mm-hmm. I guess I'm trying to understand, because I'm looking at the budget that we were given this summer to look at, the special or student services budget, which is your umbrella, it was reduced $500,000 from 2014-15 to 15-16. So I'm trying to, the budget that's monitored, is that our whole budget, or is there just a portion of the budget that we can't?
I mean, maintenance of effort is really around specialized instruction, so our service providers largely, administration, speech and language pathologists, special education teachers.
The staffing.
Right.
So where you'll see the biggest difference from last year to this year is in private and public tuition. Private tuition is something that will ebb and flow throughout the time. So private tuition was budgeted at 500. I apologize. Yeah, my glasses. 720,000 a year ago, 600,000 this year, and that's really dependent on each individual child and their placement. So that's one that, when we look at it, it won't be one of those variables within MO, because that's a placement of tuition, and then the public school tuition. Our actuals was 1,100,000, and what we budgeted for was $1,200,000. So we did have original budget year for the 14-15 1.5. So that's what accounts for those numbers, is the reduction in private and public tuition base. When you go up to personnel, and that's a big, as Michelle just noted, that's a big one where Mo will really focus in on, when you really look at those numbers there, you see that it's pretty much a wash. There's an increase this year of a little over $1,000 in the benefits and salaries for the district.
But I guess that's where I think Stephanie and I have been trying to ask this. We brought six, and maybe I'm missing something. We brought six kids in,
mm-hmm.
more greater needs than any of the kids we have. But from a staffing standpoint, we only increased it by $1,000.
But within that, remember, there's retirements, there's other people coming and going, so the budget itself was within staffing. We did not eliminate one aide, one teacher. There may have been retirements, and we replaced them with different personnel, but there has been no change in the total number, other than we hired Andrea as a behavioral specialist for the district, but there's been no decrease in overall aides.
Is there an increase, though?
And I think that's, you know, a question you would ask before is, if we brought students back, how was there mm-hmm. an increase? And so when we brought students back, then, because we didn't add sections, and some students that were in those self-contained classrooms mm-hmm. were then, they are now resource students in one of the four elementary buildings. And so because, in general, our self-contained numbers are pretty low, that if it's a couple students going to another school, it didn't add staffing. It would have, it would have been at one particular school, but because they were spread among the four, it didn't show that we needed to increase.
We didn't need to add support staff to those students going from a self-contained classroom back to gen ed. We didn't need more support.
Staffing
is determined by the IEP minutes for each of the buildings. So Michelle needs to put a different whether it's OT, speech and language, and it's more for CASE with that too, because I'm not CASE employees, to make sure that it's in line with the students.
And I mean, I'm sure we're following their IEPs, but I think I'm more, I guess, kind of questioning the whole philosophy overall as a district as to how we're approaching this. Totally lost my thought, but I know we save money bringing these students back that are outplaced, some private tuition, which that is obviously the premium, which there's going to be some savings there. But the students that were placed within CASE, you know, we do pay an overhead to CASE, but a lot of that money, I mean, it's just one public entity to another, and it's not a profit-making situation. I mean, I would assume those monies should be coming back to our district
for educating those kids within our district and providing them the resources they need within our district. So there's, from public school to public school, a little bit of savings with the overhead we pay case, but I think part of the concern that I know I've heard from parents is, you know, that money shouldn't just be a savings on the line item for the school district. It should be going towards the resources and education for the kids we're bringing back and the kids we're kind of shifting around within our schools. And I completely support that we need to do more inclusion and get kids in the classroom. I couldn't have said it any better than Mrs. Kaminsky there. But I think we have, it's one thing to do it in practice. It's another to provide the appropriate resources so the kids and the teachers and their classmates can all be successful. And I think that's one area that I have concern with.
So your question is, are they making sure that, again, those dollars that came back as a result of bringing the children back, you know, utilized within the special education fund?
And I don't know
if the find them,
I haven't been on the board all that long, so I don't know if we've put pressure on the department, like we need to try to, we're going to save this money, we need to not add costs.
No, it's never a discussion.
So, I guess
the question comes, where is that money?
So it's, as Michelle said, it's within the IDEA flow-through, and we're still getting that same amount of IDEA flow-through, and that has to go into the student's education. Remember, each one of those students, it's an individual education plan, so a team comes together to make the decisions about that child and their needs. So for me to sit here and talk about each individual child and their needs and what they need, a team makes that decision.
Yeah, well, we're not asking that. We're just trying to figure out the flow through. We've added six kids with more needs than we've probably ever seen, and we're happy. I'm happy they're back.
You know, I just want to be a little careful. We're talking about six kids.
Yeah.
And just for confidentiality, it wouldn't be that difficult to figure out who we're referring to and having significant needs. I think we need to be careful.
I don't know who those kids are. I'm asking a budget question. They're a small subgroup. I apologize. Reference them as a small subgroup. But at some point, we don't know where this money's gone. We can't figure it out. And we've asked this question.
That.
I mean, well, I, well nobody's yeah. answered the
what
question.
Money are you referring to?
Yeah. Well, I think Stephanie asked the question.
I think the question originally was there was a supposition that these dollars, having done some savings, are not being put back into the children's education. Mrs. Gallo, if you can say again what you said, how you determine that.
Well, I just want to clarify. Maintenance of effort is for state and local funds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we also have the IDEA grant. So there are, and that is, so maintenance of effort is, we need to make sure that we are meeting our maintenance of effort in order to get the IDEA grant.
Right.
So just to, and again to clarify, at the end of last year, we spent $6.2 million in rough numbers. This year, or 15-16, we have budgeted a little over $7 million. What we spent was $6 million, and what we allocated next year is $7 million, or this year. I mean, that's what we spent. Those are the actuals, and again, this was...
Last year's budget was $7.2.
Yeah, and I'm just talking about what we spent. That's all I'm saying. So when we talk about last year, within that's what they. I thank you. That's a much more eloquent way than what I said.
I know.
Where are we at for this year? If we've added no staff, I don't think that we've added any staff. Is what I'm getting out of that in terms of. Okay, well I guess we're asking. Dr. Burns, so there's been some. Attrition and some of those things, we're trying to figure out. I mean, this can't really be that hard. I mean, we've been asking it for 6 months. We're trying to figure out. So how many staff have we added? We brought that subset of group of kids in. How much staff have we added to help support them? That's the direct question.
And Michelle, to answer that question.
Because we had to add an additional classroom. So students that were in those classrooms prior, to make sure that they also had a program in a less restrictive environment so that we can meet their needs in more of a resource model. Because they moved on to four other schools, there was no need to add staff as students transferred out to Hadley. and those students moved on to elementary. We didn't, the numbers did not show that we needed to add staff. We are in continual conversation as the year goes on, but our numbers are kind of fluctuating, and if the need arises, then that is something that we advocate for, and that I know that Karen, Paul, Lori, and the board has been supportive of if we needed to add staff. That is something that those conversations take place all the time.
Well, and I think my concern, and I apologize to everyone here, maybe you don't know what I'm talking about, but I know there's like a triangle of the levels of special education, and our self-contained classrooms are like three levels down. And I know, you know, we moved students out of those classrooms to make room to bring students back in, and we moved them to really, you know, our top level or maybe one down, Gen Ed or Gen Ed, where they get pulled out for some resource time. And I mean, how are we doing that without providing more staff or aides? Or, I mean, to take a child who's in a self-contained classroom and put them in a gen ed classroom, that's a big transition, and I'm just concerned that we're not providing the appropriate number of support.
There isn't a model that you could say this is what we do for all kids in a resource setting. That really is individualized, so the answer is different for each one of those students.
But I think, I guess, just in talking with other districts and other parents, I think the way that it's handled in other districts and the way we handle it is very different. And I think that's where
I guess that's something we could talk about. Because I don't know that it is.
Question.
Yeah.
You know, and I can jump to a different question.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments on that too. So Franklin, who has had the self-contained programs, does a good job of working towards finding appropriate opportunities for kids to mainstream. And kids didn't move just from a full self-contained program to being back in Gen Ed with resource services, so they have been mainstreamed along the way. Michelle kind of referenced that she met with them and talked about it. At the start of the year, there's always kind of get back into the school mode in that. The resources that the Franklin team had identified going into the school year were purchased, whether it was physical resources, things like that. And then as they had requests for things, like there were some chairs they wanted in that, those purchases were made. The other thing I'd like to comment is that I don't think we tend to equate people with resources. Self-contained programs can have up to 12 students. We don't ever take our classrooms up that high because we recognize that those kids have a lot of needs. And sometimes the more adults you have in the room with aides in that, the more dependent you're making kids instead of increasing their independence, which is our goal for all kids. Michelle kind of talked about their first and foremost a generalized student. So I just think it's important that because we brought them back, I don't think we were ever thinking, okay, it costs us this much for them to be someplace else. Now we're going to take that money, give it to Franklin's self-contained program, and let's see what you can get. Or, you know, do we need more people or whatever? And, you know, it probably hasn't been perfect. It's always different when you get new kids back in the classroom and that. But the actual class sizes for those programs are reasonable. I don't think we have any more than six, maybe seven in one of them. Jeff, you probably know about.
We have four, six, and nine.
And nine, I think, is for the mainstream. So we obviously want to look at that. And you know, I just think I feel like we need to be careful that it isn't always about just getting more staff. I mean, sometimes that's even harder to manage for a teacher when you've got three or four things in the classroom and keeping that going and that. But, you know, Jeff and I spoke a couple weeks ago about, you know, some of the teachers went and did an observation in another district. They were going to talk about it, and then we're going to meet with them and have another conversation. What did they learn? What are some things we can do differently?
Thank you. I guess, you know, I know we're pushing for more inclusion, which is, you know, definitely impacts the staff and the students in the class. But, you know, what are we doing district-wide to ensure that teachers have adequate support? How are we monitoring that with the teachers?
for full inclusion students or just any student who's included?
I guess really, I mean, anyone, like any teacher in the district that's, you know, working with a child with an IEP or special needs, how are we monitoring it to make sure that we are providing the appropriate amount of support that that staff needs to give?
In several different ways. I mean, from their day-to-day interaction with their individual grade level team and their PLC team, to the teacher herself or himself monitoring their IEP goals, through MAP data. I mean, really, there are so many different ways that we're monitoring it. Each student has a very unique and different IEP with different needs to come up with services. So,
and I think if the teacher's struggling and they meet and support as a group, if a gen ed teacher felt like they were struggling with a student who was included, they would get together and talk about, you know, what do they think is kind of the reason for that, what's needed to help that child be more successful, because we don't want to quickly pull them out of that inclusive setting. Mm-hmm. We want to work with it to kind of help build.
Thank you.
I have other questions. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. And, you know, I just want to say, you know, to, you know, Michelle and Paul, I know I'm asking a lot of questions, and, you know, I'm not trying to place blame on anyone. I just want us to make sure we're moving towards a solution. And mm-hmm. I know you both have said that, you know, special ed is important and you're trying to do that. And you both inherited a lot of issues that you did create. And I'm aware of that. And I'm just, you don't always hear about things from parents. They're struggling for a solution for their child, and it's an emotional process. But, you know, I hear mm-hmm. from a lot of parents, and there is concern from the community. I mean, I know a lot of parents have talked to professionals in the medical community because they've had concerns about what's going on with their child. And, you know, if you hear talk to people from, like, Lurie Children's Hospital, we have District 41 has a reputation for not being a strong special education program. And I would like to change it. And, you know, I'm not just talking about the 12% of students that have IEPs. I mean, any student that's not even identified in our district. And I think that we have great staff, and we need to make sure we're providing them the support. So I just wanted to say that because I have a couple more questions. And I just, sometimes I feel like we're ill-equipped to handle things. I know we've brought back students, and we're talking in our capital improvement projects to make improvements to Ben Franklin to really provide for some of the students that we've brought back. And part of me thinks, I know that came about this year, like in the spring, probably when they had their IEP meetings, but was any thought given to, you know what, we're going to do this and we're going to do it right. We're going to get the facilities where they need to be so we can provide these students with the same or at least the same or better learning environment than they're coming from? Because I wonder, are they getting equivalent to what they were getting at the schools they came from? Or did they kind of take a step back? And maybe if we had actually talked to the parents and said, hey, look, you know what? This is our plan. We're going to follow this. We have some capital improvements we need to make. If how they would have responded to that, because the bathrooms, the playgrounds at Franklin, I know, are on the list for capital improvements for next summer to make them ADA compliant. And you know, that's just one example. I know I just saw in the paper District 89 has added sensory rooms for students with intellectual disabilities. Mm-hmm. And I know we don't have those in our district, and I know that can be a space issue, but if our priority is bringing kids back, we need to provide the facilities. I mean, for the staff, for the students, we have to have the facilities that are needed to handle these things. And
Stephanie, are you asking to have that kind of forecast type of program or process? Is that the question? What is Michelle thinking? Well, let me ask Kurt. What is Mrs. Gallo thinking as the director? What is Karen's, you know, insight on this? So is that the question that you're asking? What's the plan moving forward? Are there numbers of children that parents are saying we want our children to come back? What's the plan?
No, I guess not necessarily that. I'm just giving examples of how I feel.
Right. You said you had a question, so I'm trying to try to figure that out.
Question question would be, like, for example, I know we have the preschool program, the structured program for preschool for students with autism, but do we have a plan within our district to manage those? Do we have sensory rooms to help those students at all of the schools? Do we have, you know, I know we've hired a behavior specialist, but I've had questions from people, why is our behavior specialist not BCBA, which is a board certified behavior analyst? You know, so that would be a question. How are we have one piece of the wheel for students with autism, and I think, you know, autism is definitely something that we're seeing an increase of. And are we prepared to handle that and putting the resources and tools in place to do that?
I mean, I think we are. And I think that there are, it's hard to compare district to district, and I would hate that to make a comparison of what the students have maybe in their other buildings. If I felt that it was a detriment to bring them back, then with the communication with the parents, I don't think we would have come to that decision to bring the students back. So I don't think that they had better or different facilities or programs in the other places. Maybe a sensory room, things like that, that we don't have in all of our buildings. Of course, I take that feedback. What can we do that we're meeting our students' needs? But with things like that, I wouldn't want to say then you remain outplaced or you don't get to attend your home district because of those things. I don't know if that would outweigh the opportunity to be a District 41 student attending a District 41 building.
Mm-hmm. But are we...
I want to go ahead, Drew.
I'm sorry, the subset of six. Can you tell me that there has been ongoing monitoring that assures the district that all the students are monitored appropriately
across the
six?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, just talking about the six that came back.
You know, but honestly, I can't monitor those six differently than all of our students with IEPs. So it is something that we are, all of our students, we aim for them to make progress by their individual goals that are, you know, 12-month goals. And we, all of our teams strive for their students to make progress for those goals and to meet their goals at the end of that IEP. And then they write new goals for the next school year.
But Michelle, you're coming back in the spring for a report, right? We're doing I forget if we have her on annually. I'd have to look.
Not sure.
But it sounds like, well, what it sounds like from Stephanie is that there are some, you know, questions, maybe even in the same way that Patrick was asking about the forecasting from a financial standpoint, you know, that plan that certainly is fluid, but what that might be. And I think it would, you know, it's helpful to see what's out there. The question is always, and I guess that's why I raise it, even with the numbers shifting, and like you said, it's always going to be around that 400. But, you know, what's the projection? What do you see, even from a perspective of more profoundly challenged, you know, is that shifting kind of what your view is? And I think that's helpful for the board to understand, too. That you've asked a lot and made a lot of comment about it, but I think that's the essence of what I'm hearing is, so, you know, are we doing what we say we're going to do? Are we doing, you know, not just by law, but in the best effort for the children, certainly, and I hear you saying that you are.
And I guess I'm not even saying, are we doing what we say we're going to do? I'm concerned, not necessarily what we say we're going to do, as, you know, as a philosophy, as a district, you know, are we doing what's best for kids?
Right, and that's what I'm saying, is that it sounds like that's part of the response.
We absolutely are doing what's best for kids.
The question about, you know, our autism program, we have the structured preschool. Do we have a program in our district for those students once they're moving on to kindergarten?
So those are the conversations that I have with the case directors and that Karen and I have with the principals of what can we do then for more students to be brought back.
But currently, Michelle, those students are in case programs right now.
But there's not a program in.
So those are the conversations that we're ongoing now.
Facility implications. I mean, we would love to have
all of our students back.
Continuity, but we probably need two classrooms to be able to have the kids stay with us from kindergarten through fifth grade.
So we've had those conversations about what does that look like, how much space, what's going to occur.
And you want it to be stable, so if we put it in a building,
it has to stay.
Make sure we can keep it there because it's hard to move that program.
To some extent, there's been a lot of work and conversation among the directors of really what is a program and not digital students, so that we don't place students by eligibility category, we don't place kids by you have this, you go here, you go here, and that's really not what we want to do. And so we really look at students as individuals and where can they be successful. And so it might be a student with Down syndrome, a student with autism, a student with a developmental delay, a student with an intellectual disability, if that makes sense for that to be a classroom. And so it doesn't need to be just an autism program or just a program like AIP. So trying to move away from that so that we are just programming what's best for our students so that as an individual we're looking how can we make progress.
Mm-hmm. I did have one other very specific question. I'm wondering how much thought and conversation was given to special needs students with all of our initiatives. And I'm not talking to all students. So, like, wondering, Paul and Michelle, what conversations we had about the schedule this year and how that would impact students with special needs.
They were definitely conversations. How are they being impacted? But now it's about getting that feedback. How is it impacting? How can we look to make some adjustments if adjustments are needed? But they were definitely, that was a definite consideration at the table during our conversations.
Do we have a plan that if if the environment's impeding a child's learning, do we have a plan on how, solution for how we manage that? Or
within the individual child's IEP process, that is all IEP process based off of that individual child, how he or she is growing, changing, and his or her needs on that IEP.
Do we have different options, like within our districts, to manage different learning needs across the board?
Yeah, I absolutely believe so. But at the end of the day, that special ed team has to make those decisions about where that student moves to, how that student's being supported. That team's a incredibly important team.
Okay, and my last comment, this I suppose is more a comment on it, and this is just feedback I've received from others, and I know there's been conversations, but I think moving forward as we're evaluating things for the district, I think we more seriously need to look at special needs students, because the feeling right now is that the model that we're working in right now is disproportionately negatively impacting students with special needs from, the specialization in the AB schedule, just the amount of transitions you put in a day for a student. Multi-age, you could pair an older student who has a learning disability with younger students just because they're at the same reading level, and that can impact self-esteem. Spanish or FLEX, it's been proven if you have language acquisition problems that these are really not programs that you benefit from. PBLs, kids that struggle, especially socially working in groups, and if our district is going to move to that plan in a couple of years to have full PBL instruction, is that going to negatively impact them? And so I'm just bringing these up because I think there are a lot of concern from parents. It's a smaller percentage of our school district. You could say 12%. I think you could even include, some of these things impacting at-risk kids or ELL kids as well. Those aren't ones with IEPs. But I think parents that have kids that have special needs are in tune with a lot of the stuff and what's happening in the schools. And if we took a serious look at how some of these things are impacting them, I think it would shed a lot of light on how it's going to impact a lot of students. And I don't know that we do a very good job of that. There was a teacher this year who just talked about a student who's been really struggling with the specialization and the movement around, and said, basically compared them and said that they were the canary in the coal mine. That when, I'm going to get emotional, that kid is the first one who's going to go. They're the one who's going to crack, and then everyone else is going to come next. So our most at-risk kids, we are putting in situations that it's
very hard to manage, and I think we more seriously need to evaluate what we're doing in this district. Back to what that dad said at Franklin, have we overcomplicated our public education in District 41 to the point that it's negatively impacting, I think, all kids and all teachers? I think we're doing, there are some things that we've changed that are helpful, but I think, I mean, I just look at this year and the AB schedule and a second grader who 1 week has art on Monday, the next week has it on Wednesday, who kids will not take their library books out of their backpack because they can't remember what day they have library. Is it on Monday this week? Thursday next week? I mean, I'm not kidding.
I'm looking at Kirk and Jeff because I know that came up.
Who love their little boots and their little cute shoes are afraid to wear shoes to school because they can't remember which day they have PE. And we're talking about 7- and 8-year-old kids who I feel like our goal should be they should learn. They should be loving school. They should love learning. They should be developing peer relationships and relationships with the staff, the schools, and even these people that we love. I mean, we love the staff. We love the administration. This is not, as Ms. Cardona said, this is not a reflection on those feelings. It's just,
I think we're going to get a lot of that data back.
It's
That's why we're doing
that. I think special ed, these kids are going to be the canaries in the coal mine, and I don't think that they've been... that we've properly vetted this stuff. I mean, I had a parent tell me today, and I know we're not supposed to talk this about specific kids, but I'm going to say this. We are trying to include kids more in general education. And we have opportunities for kids to be in gen ed more, these children that we're talking about that are in self-contained programs. And they're having issues getting them in gen ed more because the schedule is such a mess, trying to figure out, well, how can we do that and do this resource time and do that resource time because the schedule is so crazy. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, that is not the least restrictive environment for the child. If it's that complicated, we can't do the right thing by kids.
What I would ask for is that if you would guide those parents to the assistant principal, to the principal.
That's
a really important piece. So I appreciate
but
that.
But the problem
I appreciate
is the assistant principal and the teachers, they're not the ones, as I said earlier, they're not the ones coming up with all this. They're the ones who are administering it, but they aren't
Stephanie,
the ones who created the vision.
And I think that's right. I mean, I'm looking at the faces of the principals in this room, and they look, I would call, stricken. They do want and are working with the parents. And your question about moving forward on multi-age 2 and 3, your question about some of these other, you know, programs, we're going to get that feedback very quickly. And at that point, then, the administration is going to be looking at what those recommendations are. And we have to, and I'll use this word trust, that Mrs. Gallo, Mrs. Carlson, Mr. Samples, and all the people in this room who work in this district are going to be coming back and saying, here's what the feedback is saying, and here's what we need to do. And I want to hear that, and that's what we're gonna get back.
I guess we're getting feedback, but why are we not more thoroughly evaluating it beforehand to try to reduce some of these?
Well,
issues?
we're in the thick
Maybe
of that. It seems to me that's the turning point with this feedback coming back now, because now we're second and third year embedded, looking at the feedback coming back. And we have to, you know, it's frustrating, I hear that. But we have to wait until it comes back and take a look at it. And I don't hear Mrs. Gallo saying anything that she disagrees with what you're saying. It's you're doing the work for the children.
We are meeting with the self-contained teachers because part of it was weeding out how much of this is just beginning at the beginning of the year and learning the routine versus, okay, now it's almost November. What do we need to put some changes in place?
But I've seen, I mean, no offense, yeah. I've seen the schedules that they're working with, and they're insane. I mean, it's insane, even though they're small classrooms. I mean,
but that's what we're going to read about. Is there something that they need
but
to come
we're,
up
yeah.
with?
Yeah. Here,
yeah. One last comment,
making,
and then we'll move on.
We're making wholesale changes. I think we had a parent say this today. And then we're going to go back and evaluate. And we don't know what damage, what fallout we're leaving behind with our kids because we're not purposely, thoughtfully doing some of these things. And, you know, I went back and I listened. You mentioned the bathroom. And, you know, we knew prior to May 11th that we were bringing these kids back.
I have concerns why we waited until June to order equipment. We didn't have that equipment. Some of that equipment was there. Stephanie and I went into the building. We went on our own. We didn't have some of the things we asked staff about. They were honest with us about those things. But this is from you guys. At the May 11, 2015 board meeting, we presented plans to return a number of students from case supportive programs to District 41. As a result of this decision, modifications are being made to one of the two student restrooms located in the special education classroom. Among other plans, the modifications included fitting the bathroom to ADA standards. That still has not been done. And what we heard about, and again, I'm not blaming you, but due to legal requirements related to students with IEPs, the information needed for modification cannot be shared or concerned until after Michelle Gale was able to complete their IEP meetings in late April. The original estimate for that bathroom was $50,000. We got back the estimate, that was from Jack Hayes. We got back the estimate of $72,921. Mrs. Clark and I then asked Dr. Gordon at one of our first meetings, is that, so we're going to go ahead, we were going to do some modifications. We spent, I think, $7,500 to modify it. It's not ADA. So again, we've brought kids back. We didn't, and when people say trust, I have to trust our staff to do these things, but we brought kids back. We weren't prepared for them. And I think that's part of Mrs. Clark's frustration with this. So we spend $7,500. Now we're seeing in for next year that it could be upwards of $100,000 to modify this bathroom. All of this stuff in my world, the world that I live in, should have been done and decided before we brought these kids back. And that's the forecasting. But when I'm told trust, we're on it. I'm the accountability guy. And this is not accountable to me. These things were made, these decisions were made, and to use a parent from Ben Franklin, not on a different topic, but we flubbed. And there's no other way around it. And it's frustrating. And so for me, I have difficulty trusting what staff at times is telling us about decisions that we need to make. And that's why I go beyond. I think Mrs. Clark does as well. I can't speak for anybody else. But we go beyond to try and verify those things. So that's the statement.
Well, we did not flub bringing our students back into our district.
No.
The parents are happier.
No, don't. Well, we flub.
Well, that's what you said.
No. No, that's not what I said. And again,
what did you say?
You make these statements. This is interesting to me. You make these statements, and you go out to the parents. No, hold on a minute. You go out to the parents, and you say, well, I listen to my staff. You treat a board member who is one of seven bosses that you have the way that you do, and you wonder if staff is going to give you input when they're sitting directly from you and feel comfortable with that. So, no, sorry, I'm sorry about this.
We're collectively as bosses.
Yeah, one of us.
Yeah.
All seven.
We're collectively
as
board.
I can't directly do anything as an individual member,
right.
But I am one of the seven people that's sitting here.
I think I want to close this conversation.
No. You're going to let me correct this, because what I said was we flubbed on doing this bathroom. We didn't flub on bringing the kids back. We flubbed on this bathroom. And this is the problem. Nobody around here will admit that we flubbed. You'd be better off saying, you know what, we probably didn't handle that well. We appreciate the input. We're going to try and modify it next time. But nobody can do that, which is why I get really concerned about when we talk about modifications to what we need to do in the future, that nobody will modify anything. We're just going to keep charging ahead, and we're going to keep using terms like embedded and hope that the people forget how we used to do things so that we just continue to do them the way that we are, whether it's good or not.
Last comment on this. Mr. Scarmato, you do not need to speak, but I know you've explained this a couple of times in terms of the bathroom and the modifications and the cost and the reason that it went up and the decision that was made and that the parents understood what they would be coming in with in terms of usage of that room. Right. Thank you, Mrs. Gallo. Thank you, Mrs. Carlson. All right. I want to certainly encourage you.
We
need to leave. We'll take a five-minute bio break. And so we'll return at 10:11. Please feel free to stay. If not, our next discussion that Joe Buchensky will facilitate is the Administrator TRS compensation. All right. Well, welcome back. I know that Drew's on his way back. The next discussion is Administrator TRS compensation. Joe's going to facilitate that as it's come into Finance Committee first and now to the board.
Sure. Quickly, I want to just give a little background. Lori gave us TRS 101 and 102. that can be assisted. Bob gave us a little report. Tour design, we got lots of materials. Lori did a lot of research on certain districts that we had kind of all talked about and gave her feedback and kind of took the ones that were in the exact criteria, but were at least the majority of us had agreed should be on there. And then we collected the data, and it took some time. And personally, I appreciate it. I'm sure all the board members appreciate the data because that gave us a lot to think about. TRS overall, the good philosophical discussion about budget that's appropriate for this board to discuss, and I'm glad it's an agenda item tonight. One thing I'd like to do, and I guess you can tell me what you're thinking into this, but we are late here. This is a topic that I think needs full vetting, full discussion. And I don't want to in any way cut it short. So, what I would like to recommend here is we take all about, say, 2 to 3 minutes to get our thoughts on the table individually. We don't debate the issue, we just get our thoughts out there. Let us think about what everybody, what they're thinking about the topic, let the audience, let the public understand what our individual thoughts are, and we can bring it back, hopefully on the next agenda, Erica, and we can have a deeper dive into it, and kind of maybe get more in a full-blown discussion. Board members think that's good, just given the time of the evening and the complexities of this topic.
I think that's a good idea.
Okay.
Other board members? Okay.
I'd like to do that, just because if we're going to, whatever we do, stay the same, move forward, move back, whatever it is, it's going to be something that we're going to have to flush out. This is going to set precedent for the district going forward, I think.
Okay.
With that said, is 2 or 3 minutes good for everyone?
I think so.
Okay. Stephanie, you want to lead us off?
No, I don't want to go first. I just talked a lot.
Big water.
Okay. Drew,
no offense.
Kurt?
I'll go first.
Okay.
I've reviewed the material, and I've listened to some of the arguments that we'd be in an uncompetitive situation. Maybe this was something we did, but my thoughts on it are simply that, and I probably talked to 150 taxpayers, and I've outlined the teacher portion, the administrator portion, which is zero on that side of it. But I've not had one person say to me that they feel that we should be paying the administrator portion. So for me, and I'm going to make it easy in my two minutes, I don't think that we should pay it. I don't think that we should take it over or take it away from them overnight, that we should allow them some time. But I do think that a 3 to 5 year time frame to remove it is fair. I don't think we'll be uncompetitive. I think we'll still get plenty of candidates. I think our salaries are high enough as I viewed them, more than fair on our salary side. And so for me, however that would happen, but again over a 3 to 5 year period, and any new hires that from assistant principal up would not be eligible for it from the start. So that's my position on it. That's it.
I'll go, Joe. I think it is a value in attempt to try to look at our expenses as a district. I think the grandfather clause would be how I would like to see it go forward if we decide to go forward with this. I think what we also need to do is we need to make sure that we understand that, not only the human resources conversations about that, but the expectations of this. Let's make sure we set expectations that if we decide to go forward with in a different direction with this, what's it truly going to be in terms of, I think, what people truly consider is their wallet, right? Let's make sure that there's a clear understanding that if there's going to be a direct impact to people's taxes, or is it going to be hidden? So I think that's got to be fleshed out directly. A budgetary item aligned with levies don't necessarily align with reality and expectations. So whatever we do, I think we just have to be prepared that says if we go in a direction, but we need to make sure the community understands that whatever that dollar amount is truly may not represent a levy tax reduction directly associated with that reduction. I'm not saying we shouldn't look at this and we shouldn't strike it down to zero or whatever it's going to be, because that's part of the budgeting and finance process. It also goes into the forecasting. Again, I'll reiterate that. That has to be a not only a next year, but a 3 to 5 year conversation. But I think whatever direction we have to go, it has to be a grandfathered clause.
Yeah, I know. When I look at the TLS, and, you know, I'm not prepared to just automatically cut somebody's salary by 10%. I don't think that's a fair and equitable thing to do, right? I think if you're going to eliminate that, is you phase that out over a period of time, but you need to offset that with the dollars that are being taken away. So it's kind of you're just kind of changing it from one piece to another. You're not theoretically reducing somebody's salary. I'm not sure that doing that really gets us anything. All we're doing is ultimately increasing salaries offset by the fact that we're no longer offering that benefit. So, but if the board has an interest in doing it, you know, I would be in favor in doing it in such a way that it doesn't impact people negatively. That is, the staff members involved would not be negatively impacted by this. This phase out.
Stuff you need to know?
I'm looking something up, sorry.
You know, so we'll wait. 3 seconds or?
I'll go after Drew here. It seems as though it's become open season right now on teachers, cops, firemen, anyone with a pension in this state. And so the latest direction is this TRS. And I'm aware that the teachers pay for their TRS themselves. And I'm also aware that we have 16 people, I believe, in this district who, as part of their total compensation package, we've extended to them to pay TRS. And that's how we hired them, and that's how they made a decision to come work here. And we have attracted people to this district who are very good people that made decisions based on what it was like to work here, but also what they're going to get paid. They have bills they need to worry about, and they make financial decisions for their family. So if it's stylish now that we have to jump on this because a few other districts and a very few other districts have done this, I guess we can do that. But when we compared ourselves to other districts, we found that most of the districts pay this. And then we found that the one district that we could find the information on who didn't pay it paid substantially more than we did to their employees. So if the point is that we're doing this because we want to be able to say we took TRS back from these 16 out of 470 people, I think it would be disingenuous and mean-spirited to ask them to take a 10% cut in their pay because of this, just so we can jump on a bandwagon. I say if we're going to do this, what we should do is we should say, fine, we're not going to pay TRS. We're going to immediately make everybody whole, and that will not affect a normal increase that they would get based on merit. So if someone is up for a merit increase based on how they've worked over the last year, we should apply the same percentage. So if this is 10 and they were going to get 3, they should get 13%. We can take away the TRS, and we too can pay our administrators more than other districts do in salary, but less in benefits. Because I know when people make a decision, they make a decision based on the total compensation. And this is exactly how businesses hire people. This is how I hire people. And they always want to know, what is the total? Not, you know, if you hire someone and give them a big salary and tell them, by the way, you don't get any vacation and you don't get any health benefits, they don't work for you. And this is competitive, and it's getting harder to hire people now. It's not easier. And it's showing up in every industry. So I think if we're going to do this as a board, the fair, equitable, and ethical way to do it would be to make everybody whole. Just do it at once, make everybody whole, and then carry on if that's the way we want to be. But I think a lot of it is much ado about nothing. I think we're, you know, unless we take it away, at which point then you should expect a wholesale migration of our administrators from this district, because there is no fair way to tell 16. It's 3.4% of our employees that they should take a 10% discount, 10% cut in pay, and everybody else should be just fine. Move on. If we want a 10% cut in pay from our these 16, we should take it from all 470, and I don't think any of us would want to do that. So that's my position on this, and I think we spent a lot of time on it already, too much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm ready. Thank you for the time.
No problem.
A couple of things I want to say about this. I think certainly if we have a contract with an employee, we need to honor that contract. But, you know, a lot of, I think, maybe not all, but most of the administrators that fall into this category, their contracts are year to year, if I'm correct. So I think, you know, every year, things can change, is the way I understand it, because the contract, it's a year-to-year contract. So I certainly wouldn't want to do anything that violates any contract, but if things can change year-to-year, then I see that that is something different. You know, as far as Dean's comment, harder to hire, I don't know if that's necessarily true. Last week at the coffee when a parent had expressed concern about the number of teachers retiring from our district. You know, Paul had said we get hundreds of applicants that our district is very desirable to come to, and so I don't know that it's harder to hire. It's just my opinion. Comparing us to the, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Larry, the two districts that we found that don't pay TRS are Glenview 34 and Indian Prairie 204. Is that correct? And looking at pay, I think Glenview, yes, is on the high end in the salary, but Indian Prairie is actually on the low end. So I don't think that the districts that don't pay TRS are outperforming us and paying substantially more than we are. I don't see those same numbers. I guess my big take on this is that I think we need to somehow reduce our budget. We have cuts from the state that could possibly be coming. Do we have to pay for full-day kindergarten? Are we going to be impacted by the Cadillac tax, which I was going to ask if we could get an update from Becky on that, maybe at a future meeting. I keep hearing about the Cadillac tax.
That's 2018.
I know. Bear with me a second. And there are no, I know, you know, salaries make up 80% of our budget, if I'm correct. So there's not a whole lot of ways where we can cut things. I know when we ask the principals to reduce their budgets at the school, there's not a whole lot they can do because it's a lot of salary. I know the teacher contract, with the exception of Mr. Buckles and myself, the rest of the board just locked us into that teacher contract through 2018. So there's nothing we can do there as far as savings. And so I'm just trying to think of, is there ways that we can cut and be prudent and prepare for the things that could be coming our way? And our contracts are year to year. I definitely think, you know, I would recommend moving forward that we don't pay it for new administrators. And for our existing ones, you know, maybe I like Kurt's recommendation. Is there a way we can look at reducing it over 3 to 5 years. The administrators do get, I know last year there was like a, their compensation was determined by the superintendent, and there's monies there that can determine, you know, maybe can offset some of that differently for different administrators based on their performance to try to offset if we do start cutting away TRS. There's creative ways, I think, to handle that. So that's my recommendation.
Erica, since you're the president, are you going to
do that? Oh, you're so sweet.
I'll take the next one. You can have the last one.
Oh, you're going to do the next one? Oh, okay.
Go ahead. For me, you know, this is, well, a couple of things when looking at it from the TRS 101. For me, maybe everybody knows this, but, you know, just to me, it's important to point these things out. People who earn salary pay Social Security. That's our bucket that we throw money into. These individuals don't have a bucket of Social Security and TRS. This is their equivalent to the bucket. I think everybody's worried about, you know, if they'll be able, the younger people, I don't know that I fall into that group, but that will have money in their Social Security bucket when they need it. And the same seems to be true for TRS, and that's why this is a hot button, and I truly understand it. And I think this is a board discussion. This isn't for the administrators to discuss, and that's why we're leading it here. I think that's the right thing to do. And the other thing is, in the contracts, and Stephanie, there are mostly one-year contracts, you're correct. There's two multi-year contracts, but there's mostly one-year contracts. There is a mitigation, what I call mitigating provision in there that the board can choose to pay if there's an increase above the baseline of that contract. And the reason I bring that up, I think it's a good clause to have in. If there was a big jump from when that person was hired, it would be our choice to pay it or not pay it. When I look at this issue, I look at it from two perspectives. One is the current administration, and I think you used the word made whole. I look at this whole thing that we asked Lori to put together that you haven't seen it as many, many different parts. Certain districts do a lot of different things, from, you know, annuities to wellness benefit to tuition reimbursement. In my world, we call it a compensation basket. We get a compensation basket. It's A plus B plus C plus D, and obviously here it goes all the way past the L, maybe to M, and that equals X, and X is your compensation. So whenever you're changing A, you may find out that, hey, we should change C because the X is what's important at the end of the game. And people value things differently, clearly. So a TRS may, by some individuals, be valued very highly. Hard for me to individually know. But at the end of the day, for me, I'm not going to go out and change somebody's compensation basket if they're on our team. They're a team member. We treat them like team members. And to me, I'm not going to change somebody's compensation basket. I'm going to keep it the same. I think the other end that I look at here is TRS, is how do we mitigate the risk that's associated with TRS? That's where I look at it, because we're budget's a big thing, and others have talked about this, and we're state funding, where's this, where's that? What's going to happen with TRS in the future? Is it going to pop up to a much higher percentage? You know, and that's where I look at it and say, how can we mitigate this risk? Is this clause within this contract, it's prudent, its baseline changes every year, and for me, maybe that's not the case that we should be at, because if the baseline jumps to 15, then really we're only protected from everything greater than 15%. So when I look at it, I want to get a clear understanding, and this is in the future for new hires, is thinking about a better way to mitigate that risk. And I would lean on some of our professionals, and I'll look at Becky to see the things that are done out in the marketplace, because that's the best indicator for me. And we kind of see what other people are doing, but to help us mitigate that risk, what is out there? Let's learn from others, and maybe let's utilize it. Let's talk about it, and let's utilize it, because I certainly believe that we should mitigate this risk that falls in this, you know, third rail of TRS, if that's what you want to call it. So that's my thoughts on it right now. And I appreciate everybody giving me thoughts because it helps you think.
Well, I'll take that as a jumping off point because in listening to the, I haven't been able to attend Finance Committee because of work, but in listening to the conversations, that one of the key to this is this overarching concern, and we've all raised it on some level about what is going to happen at the state, and you don't know that. We know that the Illinois State Supreme Court struck down the change to pensions as being unconstitutional. I don't know that that will change. That was a pretty hard-fought battle, and that was a case that some of us watched pretty closely. The other piece of this, and I brought copies of this if anybody wants one, but this is the language in that administrator contract that Joe is referring to, and I'll just put it out for the record. What it says is, if either or both of the foregoing contributions are increased by law or by TRS during the term of this contract, this is the administrator contract, the board shall confer with the assistant superintendent, in this case it's an assistant sup contract, and make a determination in its sole discretion, that means the board, in its sole discretion, whether to pick up and pay all or some portion of the increase or otherwise adjust the compensation of the assistant superintendent. So to me, what that does from first kind of mitigation is it puts the board representing the district, the budget, the future, future looking forward, in a position to say, state of Illinois changed, TRS now requires another 5% per, and the board comes together and we make a decision about what we do about that. We don't pay it, we pay a percentage of it, we shift, whatever that might be. But at fiscal year 2013, that got built into these contracts, all the administrative contracts. So we're already, in my opinion, mitigating the craziness in Springfield on some level because we don't know what's going to happen. The other thing that I pulled that out was the TRS. There's a PDF of all TRS, like explaining it, which is very confusing. But, I go back. I know that we do a lot of look-backs in our district around for our budget, like what's hold firm, what percentage of change do we see dollar shifting, whatever that might be. And I found this interesting, so I just wanted to share it with you. TRS contribution started in July 1933, at least on this list. It goes July 1 to July 1, 1971 to 1995, that was 24 years, the contribution percent didn't change. From 95 to 98, those 3 years, the contribution amount stayed the same. It was 8% of earnings, 7% retirement, 1% survivor benefits. What did change in those 3 years was the retirement required minimum per year. It's now $192, it still is today. But for 27 years, there's no shift in earnings based on how TRS is investing and calculating. Another 7 years, 98 to 2005, that's when it went up to 9%. So we saw that shift, and that held firm for 7 years. And then for the last 10 years, 2005 to the present, what was added was the ERO, or the early retirement option, of 0.4%. So it's stayed at 9.4% now for 10 years. Now, I know it's not a given, but I think in the scheme of the conversation, when we talk about what holds firm, what doesn't, we have TRS is giving their contribution history, and you can see, by these numbers that it stayed firm. So that's another, to Joe's point, concern in terms of trying to mitigate, that risk. It's historically stayed very stable. And again, qualifier. We don't know that, but that's the data that I pulled to share. And I'm happy to make copies of that, too. I want to point out, because I had to ask this to make sure I understood it, but in the compensation comparison that Mrs. Campbell shared with us, she has positions listed and then low salary, a per diem, and then years of district experience, so what those years are. And then she shares the school district that, is my understanding, is aligned to that position in terms of it being a low salary. So if we said Carroll Stream, they show up three times on this list. So they are that low-end salary in those particular jobs, correct? Okay, great. Because, like Stephanie said, Indian Prairie shows up for a principal at the junior high middle level. Wheaton 200 shows up at a district-certified position. Queen Bee 16 shows up
at you know, assistant principal elementary. So I share that because I think the last thing I want to say, and just as a you know, looking at this holistically, is in the detail that we got from Mrs. Campbell, and we all informed her on the you know, districts that we wanted to take a look at. We are the norm. We are not an outlier. And so the question that I have to ask myself, and we don't know into the future. I know we don't know what's going to happen. But like Kurt, I reached out to some people too, and one is actually a taxpayer in our district, although she works at another school, but she's a director of curriculum, this position. It's a small district. And so I asked her for her insight, just generally what she thought. One of the things she mentioned is that in her district, they actually did multi-year contracts for all their directors. So they locked them in, and they found a way to kind of create stability that way, recognizing that the board was looking to have some of this conversation. So that was one thing. The other thing she said to me I think is important, and we haven't talked at all about this, and I know we'll get into more detail in the next board meeting, but it's telling to me that we have many administrators sitting here listening to this conversation, and also that we heard tonight with especially the line of questioning, which is so complex and so complicated that these jobs have become over the past, I don't know, 5-10 years for sure, but certainly at all levels, but in particular at the administrator level too, unfunded mandates that are underfunded, and at the administrative level needing to stay completely ahead of the curve as much as possible. So that's something I feel like we need to have a conversation about as a board, in terms of if we're in the norm, if we're not the outlier, and we're not the outlier in terms of salary on these as well, then, and this is rhetorical and I'll end, what is the message, both from a board perspective as well as to other districts, that that the administrators' compensation, what meaning does that have in terms of what the expectations are in District 41? Same in 89, 44, 87, any of these districts. So that's something that I'd like to delve into a little bit more next time.
Thank you, everybody. So next time, February's good, right? We'll put this right back in the session.
Yeah, it'll be on the November.
Not an actionable item, it's just more discussion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably good. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Joe. All right. So we'll get that on the agenda for November. Next one, architect interview committee.
So at our last board meeting, board members expressed interest in adding an additional board member. We've added that. There seemed to be there was consensus around adding an additional board member, so that was done. Mm-hmm. Joe?
Yeah, we were supposed to talk to this, but we got really talked about that.
Yeah.
which was a really good discussion. But they're not being boarded to us. But I agree. Stephanie brought it up. I was, I don't know, stupid fun, but I was skipping the same thing. We did it when we did it for when we hired our construction manager. I think it's, I'm on the committee as was proposed because I'm on the finance chair. So what I'd like to do, if you guys are open for it, whoever, it's a voluntary position to join me on the committee. So if you guys want to just shoot me an email.
Stephanie'd love to.
Becky. So if we have the timeline that's included on there, interviews, obviously your availability in December.
Is it the 9th and the 14th?
The 9th and the 14th. We're not 100% sure we'll need the 14th. That's the date of a board meeting.
Yeah.
We're thinking we do it before the finance meeting, and if we had to get one last interview in, but definitely book the 9th for a long, long evening. So make sure your availability. Just tell me, simple stuff, why you want to do it. We're going to, create a matrix of questions and all that good stuff like we did for the construction manager. So just bring that lens with it and your experience and say, hey, this makes sense for me to do. And then I'll review it and then talk to you guys. Maybe I'll only get one volunteer.
You might.
And it was Kurt's idea.
I was going to say, he's throwing you under the bus on that.
No, I think I seconded it. I do think it's good.
Yeah, it is good. Yeah, we had consensus on that,
yeah,
for sure.
He
called her up. All right.
So First reading of policies. So we met 2.5 weeks ago. I'm just general statement. Dean wasn't able to join us, so what we did was go through the policies and determine which are the ones that we can just move forward without real in-depth conversation at the committee. We forwarded those on to Dean. Dean was able to review those as well, and then he emailed it back and said he concurred with the policies that were moving forward. Yeah, in front of you, you have roughly 12, as in just eyeballing them, from 2.160 to 8.80. Stephanie, do you want to jump in, or just any other questions that board members may have?
I have a couple things.
But I'll start with Stephanie.
I'll just start real quick. There really weren't any that were questionable. I think I had a question on one, and we just pulled it so we could talk about that further. Mm-hmm. So we just moved the ones forward that were. These were all from press.
These were all 100% press. There was no admin, no committee changes to these.
Updating to keep it, updating with law changing and things like that. I know the only one that I. Had a question on, and I think I want to make sure that the board looks at is 2.160E.
Can you give us the page on that?
It's the second page.
Second page.
Second page.
It's the exhibit for selecting a board attorney.
It's new, and so that's something we haven't had before.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about that
so
as well.
That's my thoughts, or my comments. I'll let someone else discuss.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, if it turns into something like it turns into something for the architect review, I'm probably not interested in having it.
Isn't that what happens, Bruce?
Mm-hmm.
No, this was recommended by.
These are all press. These are
so for people listening, press is a service from the ISB that takes a look at all the law changes. They go into effect. Oh, you're going to actually give me the notes.
Yeah.
But it takes a look at all of the changes in the legal structure as it comes on. They do it about three times a year?
Yeah, 2 to 3 times a year.
Okay. And they say, okay, based on these new laws, we have to look at what we recommend for board policies and make changes. So when we talk about adopting the press changes, what we're saying is, these changes are stipulated usually by law of why they go in here. When Stephanie and I look at a policy and we go beyond that, it's because we want to do something, we want to add something to it for our district. We generally don't take something away, because if we do, we could then be risking, being astride the law. So we will sometimes add things, or when it's not, legislative, we went through different ones. We talked about the one on the busing this year and how we wanted to change that, and that was based on just some of our schedules and what the community was telling us, so we could incorporate that. So whenever we're talking about press, though, these are just changes that have happened in the law, and we're going to reflect them in our policies. So that one was another one for the exhibit.
I had a couple things. In 260, the AP1, this is the Administrative Procedure Guidelines for Investigating Complaints and Allegations of Misconduct. So we just talked about, I think the last time, no, not the last time, it was when we came back from the summertime, but that one of the updates in Springfield was the Right to Privacy Act, which has to do with elementary post-secondary schools must now provide notification to students and their guardians that the schools may not request or require a student to provide a password or other account information in order to gain access to the student's social media account. So this is, again, a little shift in terms of how much latitude a district might have in terms of investigating if there's an issue, concern, whatever it might be. And I wondered if in this, when it talks about the bullying and the cyberbullying especially, are these two in conflict? I don't know, but it might be worth a question. It's on page 204, on 2260, where it says for bullying and cyberbullying. This is the red line. The complaint manager shall process and review the complaint according to board policy, prevention and response to bullying, intimidation, and harassment. And within that, I think
is that discussion around gaining access to information to students. So I don't know if these...
We'll do some cross-references.
Yeah, if you can just look at that.
Can I ask who our complaint manager is?
So, Lori on the HR side of the house, and that's what would be proposed for currently. It's Karen, and then we need a male counterpart as well. So with those, and at which level, looking over at Mr. Samples, who would be the male counterpart to the complaint manager. But as we look into this further, it will be some areas that we will define a little bit more, because on personnel issues, I really believe that Lori should be the complaint manager. There are some pieces where Karen is, and then using our Mr. Samples for other areas, or Mr. Cuspitz, whoever wants to step up or wants to step up for that role.
Then the other thing is, and this is unique to District 41, we just had this discussion, I think Kurt was at this meeting too, but at PTA Council, a pretty protracted discussion around food and allergies.
Yeah.
And I don't mean protracted in a negative way, but it really got deep and wide. And so I'm wondering if in 735E, it talks about, this new one is the application and procedures to involve students in fundraising activities, which I love. I think it's great, and I think it's important that it's all laid out there. But in it has the question about selling food or beverage. So, you know, we're in the little midst of talking a little bit about that. I know that our professional staff, nutritionist, you know, all that, they're all working on that. But again, just... you know, is that something that we want to be doing in terms of including selling food products and or whatever?
I think it says they can't be sold. Is what it says.
It says will the proposed activity. It says yes or no.
But under the National Lunch Program, pretty clear outline. Yeah, that we cannot be selling food 30 minutes
even
prior.
For the fundraising.
No, okay. School, think
yeah.
The answer is no.
Great. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's clarification.
Yeah,
some would argue that it shouldn't happen at all on the school grounds because you're bringing contamination. Yeah.
Right. Well, I think that was more of my concern. And then the last one was just a thank you. The last one was just a typo on an 880. Item number four on 8:80 community relations. Item number four, it says, permit the district to maintain resource equity among its learning centers. So I didn't even say its.
Okay.
That's all.
You really did read this.
I actually. Former policy person.
Way to go. There you go.
And you guys, even when you roll off, you'll still read it.
You know, I had one in the attorney section under school attorney, where it indicates the superintendent, his or her designee, the board president, or each authorized to confer with and or seek legal advice of the board attorney. The board may authorize a specific member to confer with legal counsel on its behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, as I understand it, anybody on the board can confer with the attorney?
The
red lines indicate what's changed.
Right.
So it would, per the current policy...
This is 2160.
Yeah.
No, it would still be board president, superintendent,
right,
or designee of the superintendent.
Yeah, and the other piece where that comes up, Kurt, is when they talk about selecting a board attorney, that it's listed in there that the default person to collect applications, all that, is the board president, but it can be relegated to, you know, delegated to. The secretary of the superintendent, the board secretary, you know, somebody else on the board.
Yeah.
So if I had a question, I can't directly ask the attorney. Is that right?
It flows through the superintendent.
Just throws me, and then I would have Todd reach out to you.
Yeah. And that's happened in the past, where a board member has called and said, "I have a question. I think he or somebody at Forensic would need to answer it," and so it goes to the superintendent. Yes.
I know I've done it before where I've asked if you guys could check with the attorney on something.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You can do that anytime.
And is that directing the superintendent as an individual?
No, because you're asking the board president if you can If
yeah,
they can
there's
find
two.
No.
Then you would ask.
I'd have to have a good reason.
Then the superintendent could say, "You're correcting me." They ask the attorney. I've been down this road with this group, so I'm
well, Kurt. I think the bottom line is it's to know what information is being sought, right? So it's in some ways it's for the board to be transparent with each other, to know what we're asking, right? And then that information gets back out to the rest of the board.
But you could ask directly without anybody any knowledge. I'm not saying that you've done that, but you could under this policy, right?
I suppose a board president could.
And we would
not. Well, no, because then it's incumbent upon the board president, like any other board member, seeking information, because we have that built into our communication as well. What's good for one is good for all. Get that information out to the board.
And then in the board bills or attorney bills, it's also listed
it's
there,
listed,
and the
yeah.
person who was contacted or had that conversation.
That's all I had. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm trying not to read it. But I know there was a policy that said, Pauline and I talked about it once, that any board member can ask the superintendent. Is that this policy? I don't see that word in here.
I don't remember. I don't remember either.
But
we can go back and
look.
We
can look at our regular board policy.
And then also look at what the last two conversations to jog either one of our memory. Yeah.
It was a whole 2.5 weeks ago. So.
Well, yeah, I think it was 2 finance committee meetings ago that we talked about it. Any other for first reading?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Okay, action items. Are there any items, consent agenda, are there any items board members would like to be removed from the consent agenda to be considered separately? Hearing none, may have a motion to approve the consent agenda, which includes item 1, finance, facilities, and operations, treasurer's report, investment schedule, monthly revenue, expenditure summary report, summary of bills and payroll, vandalism report, disposal of surplus property, 2015-16 FOIA report, school district payment order, October 7, 2015 through October 20, 2015. Item 2, other matters, approval of board meeting minutes, October 13, 2015, regular meeting.
Motion.
Mr. Bochinski?
Yes.
Mr. Buckle?
Yes.
Mrs. Clark?
Yes.
Mr. Elder?
Yes.
Mr. Owen?
Yes.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes. Item B, superintendent recommendations. May I have a motion to approve the personnel report as presented? That was pulled, and that's our blue sheet on the table. May I have a motion to approve the personnel report as presented?
Motion.
Second.
Discussion.
Pull this for the stipend for Dave Scarmato. As Mr. Cicerella resigned, Dave has taken on a number of different roles within the district, and really his hours have increased, his responsibilities have increased. And one way to compensate for those hours that he is definitely working. He's one of the first ones here, if not the first person here in the morning, and one of the last people to work. But it really is about taking on very different roles, from meeting consistently with the architect, having those conversations, all while still having to do his primary role. So I really feel like it's an important way to compensate Dave, and I want to be clear. Dave never once asked for this. I came to the board, asked the board a few weeks ago in one of my weekly updates, just saying this is something that I would like to move forward because of the incredible amount of work, effort, and thoughtfulness that he's put forward as he's had to step up into this position, and we needed it. We could not go without his ideas moving forward. So that's why we did want to pull it. So we had an opportunity to talk about it, and so you could hear my rationale for the $3,500.
I was going to say, just to clarify the amount, so you just did. So it's a one-time.
It's a one-time stipend of $3,500.
Okay.
I appreciate that it was presented this way and wasn't put on the consent agenda. So thank you for doing that.
You're welcome.
Well, I go the other way. You have the money in your budget for this, right? This was the budget, one of your budgetary line items, probably?
I didn't have a $3,500 stipend for Dave.
You had something in your budget for this?
Not necessary for paying somebody an additional compensation. I did. I feel like it was one that I really needed to make sure the board approved for it. I, recognizing that it's under the $10,000, I see where you're going.
Why are you bringing this to me?
It's being transparent about selling.
But there's a difference between policy, board work, and staff work. So
I recognize.
On the other side, so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, just clarification. It's a stipend. It's paid equally over the rest of his checks, or
no,
one time stipend.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
I'm all for it.
Okay. Yeah, I and I are going out Friday night. Buy a snowblower.
I just have one question. Since Dave is taking on all these additional tasks and goals, could we play him, make him the male complaint manager?
Yeah.
Sure. No.
That would certainly reduce the number of complaints.
All right. I just want to clarify something. So, just clarify something. So, are we saying that because this is under $10,000, Paul wouldn't necessarily have to bring it to the board for approval? Is that what this said? I guess in my mind, then you could say,
I have expenditures up to $10,000, yeah.
We approve the budget. He has the budget. He has expenditures up to $10,000, yeah. And mostly, though, if I could just interject, for emergency things, like if there were some emergency issue and it needed to be addressed, it's the middle of the summer, there's only two board members around, there's no quorum, it allows for him to make that kind of call.
And I get that. I knew it was the $10,000. I was the question. I guess in my mind, I would agree that it made sense to bring it forward because this is a stipend. It's
sure, yeah, absolutely. That's what we said. Yeah.
People stipends all the time, so I think it was good.
It's like a spot bonus.
So I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul. Roll call.
Mr. Escalante.
Yes.
Mr. Ellis.
Yes.
Mr. Bochinski.
Yes.
Mr. Buckle.
Yes.
Mrs. Clark.
Yes.
Mr. Aldrin.
Absolutely.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, board reports.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to give one on the Ben Franklin.
Thank you.
It was given 5 times.
Very well done.
Yes, it was very well done. And, but I'll do my quick one on the facilities. We talked mostly about the capital projects, which was a long time ago, we said we'll bring forward to the board.
Yeah, we're going to bring that to the full board.
So Dave kind of gave us a presentation before, and then we really focused on the 2016-17 school year. We did talk a little bit when we bring this up. They pulled the roof amendment to FQM's architect, and that was pulled from their agenda, as you guys know. He's gone out. He believes that we should do some testing, third-party testing, cores and infrared stuff that will kind of give us a better idea before we go to that next step of FQM. Design of said improvements. So that's what we talked about. It was really a good discussion on capital projects. I thought this is different than what we've done in the past, because before it used to come to us at the end of the game, and we really didn't understand the priorities as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dave detailed the priorities. We had some discussion and some disagreement on some of maybe three of the items where they should fall in. So, but that's mainly what our meeting was about.
Good. Other board reports? No. Stephanie, do you have anything?
I don't know. Well, I went. I went to some coffee and some PTA meetings, but I think we covered.
Patrick, how about two quick ones. CIT, we had a meeting on October 15th. And just a couple of things to summarize that I think are important. We've heard tonight about professional learning communities, so. There was a pretty deep discussion around the PLCs and really focusing this year on the definition of it and then the use of both the kind of the practice and the methodologies around it, specifically about PLCs coming together to look at student work
and base those discussions on how to improve all grades, you know, all students, all grades, et cetera. Like, how are they doing that work? Mr. Samples, principal at Ben Franklin, presented information on how the PLCs view their growth on applying these principles and methods from, you know, don't know yet to, you know, not true of our team, currently working on it, our team is addressing it, to this is true of our team. So this kind of Likert scale around where are we to be self-assessing and making sure that they're focusing on staying true to the work of the PLC. TLC, Teachers Learning Collaboratively, another acronym, has started in the schools with teachers observing their peers. I understand that the substitutes are working out well so that there can be access to those folks and it can be an opportunity to get in and start using it. And I heard from a couple of teachers at CIT that they're excited because, in fact, some of the teachers who are doing our art and PE and our specials are also taking advantage of it along with special education. So that's good. You want it to be holistic. The other thing I want to report on was a LEND meeting. I know, do you guys get the LEND pushouts, the LEND invites for the meetings from LEND? Are you on the list? I always ask this every year. And
no, I don't.
I'm going to double check. I'm going to make sure that they put you on there. So just this past Friday, it was at Marquardt down the street.
Are those Darlene's emails that we get?
No, that's the Regional Office of Education. So I'll make sure they updated all the constant contact for LEND. I know that obviously I'm on it because I'm the board's rep, but I want you to be aware that certainly the meetings are available if you want to go to them. This one, there was a really good presentation on the impact of the local impact of districts, community members, and peer and awareness of those voices in Springfield. And I know it feels like a big black hole down there sometimes, but we have a couple of examples right here in DuPage County, one which has certainly impacted District 41. The first one was an e-learning bill that was initiated by the superintendent of Community High School District 94, which is West Chicago. It moved from the local level to the state level, and now it's a bill of 38 support sponsors. And it's giving kids an opportunity to do e-learning in lieu of being out of school, whether it's for health reasons or whatever, so they're piloting it. So that was one. The other one is DuPage County Superintendent specifically focused efforts downstate on changing the number of park hours and tests that students will take. And Dr. Dave Larson, our superintendent at 87, was really a lead voice in that with two other superintendents. And then LEND member districts, including 41, had to you know, provide information so that senators and representatives could see what we're doing. So it's a really to be involved is important. The other thing I want to mention is, I mentioned this the last time, but there's still the $550 million of those qualified school construction bonds, and they're making some headway with the Deputy Superintendent for Education, Beth Purvis, to move those dollars back to the Illinois State Board of Ed so that they can be accessed, that there can be some opportunity to maybe apply. I have no idea what's going to happen. Becky's keeping her eye on it. But that's a lot of money, and that maybe has some, you know, even if it's a small amount, it's something. But again, 87's been instrumental in working with their deputy superintendent. The last thing I want to mention is a program that leads right back up to what I talked about earlier, and this is like a little business card about it that each of the districts received. You can take one. And it's called the LEND Action Network. And yeah, there's a lot of feedback from LEND members like us. PTA Council has a legislative liaison. It's Bill Enright this year. And over time, there's been a kind of inconsistency around, so what does the legislative chairperson do, and also even at the school level. So for LEND, what they're looking to do for member districts especially is to create that kind of action alert that says this is the most important thing. Again, example, 2 years ago when the state wasn't paying its quarterly payments, Naperville 204 was instrumental in getting the word out, but it was a very protracted kind of conversation. So we'll be presenting this, I'll be bringing this to PTA Council. I want us to think about, again, as board members, one of our charges is to be involved state, local, state, federal, as much as we can, and I think this is an opportunity for community members to get involved. So it's all good. And that's that.
Thank you.
Nancy, I have a copy to give to you.
I had Erica.
Sure.
I went to the league. Dr. Gordon and Dr. Perdue were
talking
about
good.
A couple of different issues. Stephanie and I went. I think you were there for a while, Erica.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because
One of the things I wanted to hear was how Dr. Perdue, how they implemented full-day kindergarten at 89. And he indicated they did it with no cost increase. They did it in all their schools. There's no fee to attend. All but a dozen kids opted to attend full-day kindergarten. They said that that number was dropping each day that kids were transferring into the full-day component from half-day. They paid for it by retirement, attrition, and eliminating coaching positions by moving them into the classroom. He said D89 has limited resources and the board prioritized full-day kindergarten over expanding the technology department. So I found it interesting that they made it a priority. They found the cost savings that they could find so that they didn't have to increase their budget to provide for it. So they made some tough choices and thought it was interesting.
Yeah. You know, he talked about that about another league as well. I think the number he gave was like $20,200. You know, the cost of the program. Mm-hmm. You know, one biggie for him though is I know we've talked about this, but the fact that they have space, and there was that piece didn't have to kind of come into the conversation. But he did talk specifically about the prioritization. Most important, less important, et cetera. So it was good. Yeah, nicely done. You guys are good teammates. All right, no other board reports? Other matters. I want to mention one thing under this, and actually Stephanie, Drew came to board president meeting 2 weeks ago and brought this up. Dean had mentioned it to me as well in the interim. And then Stephanie called in to the president meeting last week, and we talked a little bit about this as well. And if I'm misinterpreting Dean or Drew, you know, tell me. But what I heard you say to me was wanting to have some conversation around the agenda item under other matters, which can get can turn into what might potentially be agenda items that we then start to talk about, but it's not posted on the agenda.
So people don't know.
Right, so people don't know, exactly. So, I mean, is that fair, Drew? From what you said as well.
Well, just the concern was that we're going to violate the Open Meetings Act by having a discussion item in the other category.
Mm-hmm. And the other, and so Stephanie and Paul and I talked a little bit about it too. And what I mentioned was that at that law conference, they gave some sample agendas, and listed on there is, this is the term that they use, future items for agenda consideration. So if there was something that we wanted to bring without going into great detail, then what I kind of like about that is that the whole board hears, I've got an interest in this, I'm, you know, concerned about this, et cetera, and then we get it, that night on the list, but that it stops there and we, you know, detail at whatever minimum level you can, but then it can get talked about as an agenda item. So
future,
I wanted to
future matters.
Yes, I future items for agenda consideration.
So
that's their language.
Do you bring them up that night, or do you tell you when you're making?
It would be that night because
okay.
Under other there's it's a hodgepodge. It's kind of a big bucket, and this might be a way to fine tune. You know, what any of us have as an interest. Yeah. So I know, Stephanie, we talked a little bit about it at the meeting.
I know I'm the one who brings a lot of them, but I think it makes sense to have that as an agenda item then. If items you want to discuss, bring them up, but not have discussion. Just
right.
And I'm not sure that the discussion is I understand and I'm okay with this, but I'm not sure that we were even ever flirting with violating the OMA. The discussion can take place. You can discuss. There's a lot of discussion that occurs on a lot of things that people don't know are going to be talked about. You can't take action on them. That's the concern, and we wouldn't be able to take action. But I'm okay with moving it on the future part of it. But I was never really concerned about the other part of it.
I think it can streamline it a little bit. And it causes us to think, because we sit on the agenda, what is something I might want to put out there? All right, thank you. Other matters that are not agenda items. Anything?
I had a couple, but I'm going to forego until the next meeting, except for one question that I had.
Sure.
This is so that Dean can get home. So I'll forego a couple of them.
I don't have to get home. I was going to play hockey, but I missed that. So I'm out now for the night.
Now I'll move those. But I know we'd asked this question. I think it's even been emailed to Dr. Gordon. I'm not sure I'll ask it again. Maybe at some point we can get a response to it. But are the first grade teachers in violation of their MOU when they're told to allow transition time before lunch? So
yeah, you've asked, and what I've done is Lori and I both reached out to the association because I feel like they should be the ones who should also give you a response. So I apologize, I haven't communicated back to you on that, but hopefully we'll have something from them.
Okay.
But from Lori's perspective, my perspective, we don't see it as a violation, but we did send it to the GIA team, and they were looking at it. So I apologize for not updating you on that topic.
That was it for me.
Okay.
I have a couple of future agenda items, but since that's not on our agenda, I'll bring it up in other matters
just
to be official. But just quickly, and I know Paul and I have talked about this. Maybe Erica was at the board president meeting. I can't remember. It's all blending together. But looking to get just a brief update on PBLs before the end of the year to kind of let people know what the plan with that is and if the continued implementation of full PBL instruction, where we're going with that, because I just thought an update would be important to get before we start surveying. Because I think we have a plan to do a full PBL presentation everything in February. So
okay.
I was hoping to get an update before the end of this year.
So just for clarification, it's kind of like where it is, how many.
You know, what's the plan? Like how many? Are we still moving towards building per year to the point where we're looking for all of our academic instruction to be in PBL? Yeah, and Franklin asked about that last week too. So
okay.
Just an update on what the plan is. I don't think that has to be a long. That's
okay.
Going to be a long.
Just the plan.
Update, just so people understand where we're heading with that.
Thank you.
This next one I put on here just because people had been asking me about an update on technology. Particularly, they were wondering about security with Chromebooks. I know that Hadley is getting ready at Thanksgiving to release those, but I did see today that there's an information meeting at Hadley. I can't remember what date. So I don't know.
This Thursday?
I'm coming up.
Okay.
So I don't know if that would answer people's questions. But I think people had asked, oh, can kids take the Chromebook home and download stuff and bring it to school? And how would that be monitored? And I don't know if there has to be a presentation here. But I know that it's a thing. It's people are talking about
okay.
it. I didn't know this.
We might discuss that when we were approving it. So.
So
getting it out there—that sounds better than for just. I don't know. It's a discussion. It's more like a district digest.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Is that how you're?
Yeah. Reminder: go to the meeting.
Go to the meeting.
Yeah.
And then the meeting. When I put this
on, remind them.
Go to the meeting.
I didn't see the meeting schedule, so that that information from that maybe we'll cover it and it can be sent out.
Perfect.
And then the last thing. This came from the Ben Franklin PT meeting. Post meeting, parents were asking about our math curriculum in elementary schools. Now, this is them saying it, not me, but they said, you know, they talk to teachers and they say we don't really have a math curriculum. We're just kind of they're working on it and they're developing it, and weren't necessarily criticizing the teachers, but they said they feel like for the second year in a row we're not using everyday math anymore. And do we have a math curriculum? It seems like math keeps changing year to year, and so that had me wondering, like, that's a question because I have no idea. I'm wondering if we could get an update on what we're doing with the math curriculum.
I don't know if I'm supposed to discuss it, but tomorrow in the second grade, there's a fact fluency basically seminar for the parents and their children.
I'm going to have to.
Well, that also varies by school too. Like they do different things at the different schools. Like,
so we can give you an update.
They're not necessarily doing it by clinic.
Okay, we can get you an update.
Thank you.
That's it.
Maybe that is in STEAM too. That's good.
Okay.
Thank you very much. All right. Anything else?
Yeah.
Oh,
well, I
go ahead.
One other item that came up more today. I will not be at the November 9th meeting.
Oh, thank you.
And I won't be able to dial in because I'm actually going to be hosting a dinner in Boston. So I have to
For work.
I have to be at the dinner,
Okay. Thank you for letting us know.
Okay.
This is my last other. This is kind of point of information. I always kind of follow the articles. That's what's going on with building downtown in Glen Ellyn.
in part because there's all this discussion around apartments.
Right.
And so that's going to be an impact point for us. So I'm going to try and get to, I don't know if I have meetings, but on November 10th is the Village's Architectural Review Commission meeting with the architect, the team that's come in to propose the McChesney property. And that's on November 10th. And then November 12th is the Plan Commission. So I don't know, just FYI, it might be interesting to listen in on those and see what's going on.
Can I ask for some thought that crossed my mind on that? Is that we get an impact from $1,500 for every bedroom, right? And that's what we get for the coffers. Okay, I believe that's what it is. But it's in a TIF district, so when they add this, we're not getting anything to our revenue because the taxes are as of 2000 whatever.
Yeah, I believe it's
correct.
And it's a 20-some year TIF that can be extended.
But I
think it's important though when they're talking about adding family units that we're limited in downtown. To the, I think it's $1,500 per bedroom. Because the only reason I remember is that because the senior living came in and
protested.
Well, we actually had a conversation at finance.
Yeah. So I just think it's good to keep on our radar with all the changes in buildings downtown. To that sometimes school is left at the last conversation, and we want to get ourselves in there. All right. Upcoming meetings, November 2nd, 2014, special workshop board meeting here at the Central Services Office at 7:30. Again, that's our board discussion around Paul's goals, district goals, looking at long-range plan.
Right. Yeah.
Because
I went in when all the emails were going back and forth.
You're the time person.
I was the time person I'll try and be there by 7:30, but I had put 8 o'clock down. So I know you guys got to do public comment and all that.
Yeah. Tom, but we'll start at 7:30.
Start on time. Expect me by the way.
And that's an open meeting.
Mm-hmm.
November 9th, 2015, Board of Education regular meeting, 7:30 here at Central Services. And then November 23rd, 2015, Board of Education regular meeting, 7:30 here at Central Services. The board does not have a need to go into closed session this evening. May I have a motion to adjourn the regular meeting?
Motion.
Second. Mr. Ellis and Mr. Bochensky, all in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much.